Okay, let's resume. The time is 4:24 p.m. For the record, the title board for the next agenda item is myself, Bill Hobbs, Dan Domenico, and Sharon Eubanks. The next agenda item is 2007-2008 number 113, which is before the board on motions for rehearing submitted by Representative Bruce and Scott Gessler on behalf of, I don't have it in front of me, so in any event, since Representative Bruce is not present, I'll just turn it over to you, Mr. Gessler.
Thank you, Mr. Hobbs. My name is, for the record, Scott Gessler. I represent Mr. Howard Stanley Dempsey.
Thank you.
Motion for and my motion for rehearing obviously focuses on both the single subject and the misleading title. And I'm happy to jump into single subject rather than address Mr. Bruce's or Representative Bruce's concerns.
Sounds fine.
That's okay. The single subject issue is one that's been discussed multiple times in earlier proposed ballot initiatives regarding the severance tax. And as I understand it, the board has generally taken an expansive view of the single subject, but also expressed concerns that they've not received adequate guidance from the Colorado Supreme Court. So this may be the case that provides that guidance. The panel's heard many of my arguments before. I'll try to be brief, but nonetheless make a clear record for the arguments before the court. What happens here is we have a funding tax increase and then multiple funding mandates. And as the petitioners or protesters in the last matter, I think properly stated, what essentially the rule that has been created is that as long as you have a funding stream, you can have disparate uses of those funds that are not necessarily connected to one another or necessarily connected to the funding increase itself. And perhaps I should say necessarily connected. Perhaps one can make a tenuous connection for nearly anything through a logical chain or a hypothetical chain of events, but one that's not fairly connected. And in this instance, we have a severance fund increase, and the money goes to the severance tax trust fund. And I'll concede that seems to be relatively closely connected to a severance tax increase, sending it to the existing severance tax trust fund. And likewise with the local government severance tax fund. But then this matter goes on to provide money or mandate money for college scholarships, native wildlife habitat preservation, renewable energy and energy efficiency enhancements, transportation projects, and even community drinking water and wastewater treatment. And I submit those are not connected with one another, and they're not connected with the severance tax increase itself. The standard, and certainly the board knows it as well, probably better than I, is that matters that are discussed in an initiative should be necessarily connected to or dependent upon one another. And these are not. They're not connected to one another. Certainly the spending mandates are not connected to one another. And I think the reality is that this board has been charged with helping make the initiative process fair. And by fair, I'll specifically focus on the issue of log rolling. And I think Mr. Ramey in his earlier comments and other severance tax matters, you know, fairly set the issue before the board, and that is this is essentially a coalition of groups or a coalition of spending mandates that help a coalition of groups. And the question is that allowed or is it in fact impermissible log rolling? And I'd argue that coalition building and log rolling are simply the opposite sides of the coin. I don't mean to put words in Mr. Ramey's mouth. He may disabuse me of my characterization. But my point is that here what you have, I think, is very clear log rolling. And I think the board should be cognizant of the fact that the rule that they have adopted in practice, at least on the earlier severance tax issues, one just earlier with respect to the real estate transfer tax, that it essentially allows groups to manipulate the initiative process, and that's something this board should be on guard against. Essentially, I think, what happens is that a group identifies that wants to increase a tax and direct the money for a certain purpose, normally one that's connected with that group's interests. And that's all perfectly appropriate. But what it also what groups also do is they craft, but they do polling, they do extensive surveying to determine what types of spending poll well within the electorate. And then they craft language for an initiative that essentially cherry picks the polling items that poll well. So if one thing polls well, they'll include that because it'll try and collect a coalition or a group of people that would vote for this who otherwise wouldn't vote for another one. So for example, someone may vote for scholarships, perhaps a student who's trying to get into college, 18-year-old student who can vote, but would never vote for transportation projects because that person doesn't drive very much. So this is sort of essentially a log rolling approach to try and get someone to support one part of it even though they wouldn't support the general approach or another part of it. And so the language is crafted to collect all of these well polling and these popular issues and to create this coalition in order to get the issue passed. And then sort of previewing my comments with respect to the misleading title, I'll at least preview. I think that's even exacerbated in these titles because not only do you get these items in here, the ones that spending for favored groups that poll well among the electorate, but then at least with this title, it doesn't even tell you what percentage goes to each one of those groups. You know, I've mentioned this before in other severance tax proposals, but it doesn't even discuss which groups get how much. So each group is can easily be satisfied that they're being heavily funded or large proportion funded, or it's sort of up to their imagination. I guess going back to the college student who's applying for college, you know, when you're applying for college, the world's your oyster. You can envision yourself going to any school or many schools before you actually have to choose. And by the same token, it's sort of the approach that every group sees its favorite pet project in there and can foresee a lot of spending going to that project. And like I said, that's exacerbated by the fact that it's, at least in this title, as I'll argue later, doesn't even have the percentages. So you can have, and I would submit that this opens up to the manipulation where a particular group gets 95% or the lion's share of money and then gives small amounts to these other groups in order to get large portions of the electorate who may not benefit all that much, but at least see their favorite pet project. That, I would argue, is the essence of log rolling. That's exactly what's going on here. That's what the Supreme Court has stated. That this is one of the purposes behind the single subject. It's what the electorate passed, and it's what this board should be on guard about. And then I would finally also submit to the board respectfully that by allowing this type of behavior, it does erode the credibility of the initiative process and increase public cynicism that it is so open to this form of manipulation. So those are my points. I understand where the board is most likely going to come out, but I would simply respectfully ask that members of the board, if they desire, state their positions again on the record so that we do have a complete record in the event of court review. And after that, I'm happy to answer questions or yield the podium to Mr. Rainey, who represents the board.
Questions for Mr. Gessler? Thank you. And we'll turn to Mr. Rainey on behalf of proponents.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And I will try to be brief as well. I'd like to characterize this a little bit differently than Mr. Gessler has on the single subject issue. And I think this is very important for the board to consider. And anticipating that we will get some guidance, as I think Mr. Domenico has it would be very helpful, I think, to all of us from the Supreme Court if a title is set, title is maintained on this measure. One could view what the proponents are doing in this case, I suppose, as log rolling, and that is, as Mr. Gessler put it, polling and finding out where to get support and where that might be most, where most voting support could come. Another way to view this, and I think actually more appropriately, in this, and really in any case, I think from the board's perspective, is that what is going on here is a policy decision. What's happening in this particular with this particular initiative is that the proponents are seeking to enhance a revenue stream. They are making a policy decision as to where the revenues from that stream should go. And more particularly in this case, they're enhancing a revenue stream from the severance of a non-renewable resource from the land, from the earth in the state of Colorado. And they are making a policy decision as to where the proceeds of that non-renewable resource should be invested, or how those proceeds should be invested for the good of the state. So a non-renewable resource is being extracted. A tax, not a fee, a tax is being proposed, and an enhanced tax is being proposed on that severance. And the policy decision is being made as to how to invest those proceeds for the future of the state in the best and most optimal way. And the extent we proceed out of the title board and are able to gather enough signatures in a very short period of time, the people, the voters in the state, will be asked to pass upon that. Our view, obviously, is that the single subject requirement should not be viewed to prevent that sort of policy decision when we're dealing with a single stream of revenue. I would concur with Mr. Domenico. It would be very helpful to the board, to us, to opposition to measures like this, to everybody, to get some guidance from the Supreme Court. The only guidance that we have at all on point to date is well, actually, we have a number of things. Most of it is really in the context of the issue not being raised very well. It was raised in 13 and 14. The court did a summary affirmance of the title board's actions after they went ahead and set a title. That's of limited guidance to the board in the future, but nevertheless, there's an indication there, I think, both of how the board at that time felt about this kind of measure and how the court felt. We do have provisions in the past, such as the tobacco tax, which invested money not only in tobacco education, but health care for the poor and other items such as that, some of the money going to the General Assembly. I'm not sure this issue was raised quite as effectively as it's being raised today. But nevertheless, at that point, or if it was raised at all, but nevertheless, that measure did proceed. Board didn't seem to have too much difficulty. I would advocate to the board that it is important when we're dealing with a single revenue stream to permit policy decisions as to the revenue to be made in a fashion that doesn't artificially constrain those decisions in a way that I don't think the single subject requirement was ever intended to do. But I would concur with Mr. Domenico that if the board maintains its title, quite confident that Mr. Dempsey and Mr. Gessler will present this matter to the Supreme Court and hopefully more guidance on that issue. Absolutely, we'll get some more guidance. I have really no further comments on the single subject issue unless the board has any questions.
Any questions or comments? Mr. Gessler?
I may just make one brief comment with respect to 13 and 14. I would agree with Mr. Ramey that the issue is more starkly presented here. If I remember correctly, in the briefs before the Colorado Supreme Court on numbers 13 and 14, the argument was that both educational and local severance fund were directly connected to the impacts caused by oil and gas exploration. And I think in this instance, there isn't that strong nexus. This argument is that there's a policy decision what to do with the revenue stream, not necessarily that these are connected to one another based upon the severance drilling itself. Severance tax or oil and gas drilling. So I think this is a little bit more starkly presented than number 13 and 14. And for that reason, 13 and 14 does not serve as very good precedent here. And, of course, as we learned in proposed initiative number 55 of 2 years ago, that the summary affirmance by a Supreme Court also doesn't provide any precedential value.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, may I respond briefly?
Yes, sir.
And I do agree with regard to the limited precedential value. I think that's correct. With regard to 14, I would remind the board that some money was going to Some of the proceeds were going into the education fund. Some were going into capital construction projects. Some was going into assembly. 13 was more. 14 really did have a number of uses, not quite as broad as the present initiative, but it did have a number of uses. And that issue was raised. Sure, or perhaps not briefed as well as Mr. Gessler will do it around, but the issue was raised, and neither the board at that time.
Thank you. Do we want to discuss single subject? Or let's, Mr. Gessler.
Mr. Ramey and I both agree on the desirability of a Supreme Court review, or at least additional guidance. I would ask for, if members of the board still agree with that, to at least put it on the record so I don't have to provide additional transcripts to the Colorado Supreme Court, pointing out that the board itself is seeking guidance, or at least some members of the board have sought guidance on this particular issue.
And I did want to open up to, you know, at the appropriate point for board discussion for purposes of making whatever record the board members want to provide. And we could move on and have that at the end, but at this point, if we want to go ahead and discuss the single subject issue, I'd suggest we go ahead and do that. Ms. Eubanks?
I'll get us started then. I'm still of the mind that this measure contains a single subject. I agree that, you know, at some point does it cross the line in terms of the various purposes for which a revenue stream can be dedicated in terms of single subject. I don't know from the legislative perspective. I've seen a revenue source be used for multiple purposes, totally similar to what's in 113 in terms of different types of programs that on their face don't seem to be connected among themselves. The single subject requirement is an outgrowth of legislative single subject for bills, and the fact that we're required to apply by statute the standards as legislative measures. At this point, I'm not willing to say that this is log rolling. Whether or not we get some guidance from the court, I think that would be extremely helpful. But at this point, my position is that the measure contains a single subject and originally saw this measure.
Mr. Domenico.
Well, I the more I see of these, the more troubled I think I am by the entire thing. I mean, I don't think it's possible, really, to imagine a clearer case of log rolling than this. I mean, it's essentially the definition of log rolling. The tax itself has two purposes behind it, it seems clear to me. And raising money is probably a secondary purpose to making it more expensive to drill and extract oil and gas, which I think is a motivating purpose pretty clearly of a lot of the proponents, to raise the cost of severance. The revenue stream is sort of related to that. And then in order to gain support for doing those two things, I mean, it's clear in the, and maybe not here, but in the papers, the proponents of these measures have made clear that they try to figure out who they need to get on board to support the tax increase. And I mean, I think if this were the inverse, and someone came in and said, we would like to eliminate the following state programs, the severance tax trust fund, the local government tax trust fund, college scholarships, any program that supports native wildlife preservation, any program that supports renewable energy and energy and efficiency enhancement, any state funding for transportation or any state funding for drinking water or wastewater treatment. I mean, it would be quite clear that that violates the single subject. And so the fact that you've got it flipped around and you're saying we want to increase money on these, you know, increase spending on these, how adding the additional purpose of adding a tax onto all of it eliminates the single subject problem is difficult to see. That said, so as a matter of first principles, it seems pretty clear to me that this is violates the single subject prohibition or single subject requirement. But as a matter of applying our obligation to interpret the initiative process and limits on it liberally to allow initiatives wherever possible, and it's sort of as a matter of stare decisis, if you will, based on our previous decisions, until the Supreme Court says that what we've been doing on these sorts of things is wrong, I think I'm going to continue voting for them, even though I, as a matter of first principles, can't imagine what the single subject requirement is for if it's not to prevent this sort of log rolling. But that said, it's not really quite my job just to impose my own interpretation on everybody, and so I'm going to continue voting for them for now.
And I have to agree essentially with the comments that Ms. Eubanks made. I think this really is a difficult issue. I can see how one could view this as a classic example of log rolling, or I can see how one can view this as quite the opposite, that this is a situation where proponents want to increase revenue and increase what government does and increase a tax, and that's what the subject is. And like the income tax or other taxes, they may go to multiple purposes. And I don't know exactly how to square those in the sense that it depends on how you look at it or maybe how it originated, which, and I'm not comfortable for the title board to inquire into the origination of language where, you know, in the sense that it leads to inquiry into the motivations of proponents. I guess where I come down on this as being influenced, as Ms. Eubanks pointed out, is that this is an outgrowth of the single subject for bills. And the legislature referred the constitutional single subject amendment for initiatives to the voters, adopted companion legislation, which is now section 1-40-106.5, where the General Assembly explained that they intended that this would extend the single subject rule that was applicable to bills to initiatives, and in doing so intended to protect initiatives from the kinds of practices that the single subject requirement for bills was intended to protect, and that includes things like log rolling. So I don't. On the one hand, as Ms. Eubanks said, it seems like the General Assembly could refer a measure raising the income tax, and it might have, by necessity, because the income tax is used for many different purposes, that. I don't view that as a violation of the single subject requirement for bills. And it seems like citizens should be able to do something like that as well. The fact that it may be viewed as log rolling, you know, the Constitution doesn't prohibit log rolling per se. It just says that the single subject is there to protect against those kinds of practices. So to me, that kind of informs our judgment about whether something is a violation of single subject, but it doesn't control it. It's not a prohibition on log rolling. And maybe I'm drawing a too fine a distinction, but I'm trying to be faithful to the legislative origins of the single subject requirement, not the log rolling prohibition. And that's, like I say, I can see how you look at this in two completely opposite ways, but at this point, based on the precedent we have, including number 14 and previous measures that I think increased taxes that went to more than one purpose, I'm at this point still under the belief that this probably qualifies as a single subject.
Can I just respond to a little bit of what you said? I mean, what you said were the two possible ways to look at this, if I remember right, is one is that it's an obvious case of log rolling, and the other permissible or optimistic way of looking at it is that the people just want to expand what government does and give government more money, which I suppose is theoretically possible that there are some people that just they just generally want more government. But the idea that satisfies the single subject requirement, that you can then say, well, we just want the government to do more and have more money, and then, I mean, that might be fine if all you did was raise the income tax or create a new tax just because you think the government doesn't have enough money. But when you then specify completely unrelated to one another purposes for which the money is going to, you, I think, then make it pretty clear that that's not, in fact, what's going on. And the reason that you specify those things, the only explanation is that you have more purposes than simply providing more money or expanding the government's role, and that it's specifically to provide money for these certain preferred programs. And if those programs have no real relationship to each other or to the tax, then the only connection they have to each other is as a way to get support for raising the tax. And I just, unless we're going to say that, which is effectively, I think, what we have said, that once the government, once you're saying we want more money for the government, you can do whatever you want with it, and you'll never violate the single subject requirement, I don't see how you can say, unless that's the line you're drawing, I don't think that you can uphold this one. And that's effectively the line I think we've adopted. And as I say, I'm not sure as a matter of first principles that complies with the single subject requirement, but as a matter of interpreting all of the provisions liberally and as a matter of not only our own precedents, but I agree that some of the precedents from the legislative history inform my decision to vote in favor of it, even though if I were starting from scratch, I probably wouldn't.
Well, Mr. Domenico, let me ask, for the sake of maybe helping me understand that just a little better, let me back up by saying my simplified way of sort of explaining the progression of thought that I have here is, number one, I think the General Assembly could have a bill to increase income taxes, and that's all it did. Now, under Tabor, it'd have to be referred to the voters, but it would be a simple bill to increase income taxes without any specification of the purposes, and therefore it would go in, the revenue, I think, would go into the general fund and would serve all of the purposes of state government that are currently served by the general fund, presumably. So any number of purposes. And if the legislature can do that, I think citizens can do that. Citizens could have an initiative to do the exact same thing. And I think that's one of the purposes of the initiative. Where the legislature fails to act or acts contrary to people's will, the people reserve the right to do, to have an initiative to do the very same thing. What I think I hear you saying is that that's maybe okay, but what they better not do is limit the use of the revenue to, they could limit it to one purpose, or they could leave it at all purposes, but they can't pick and choose the purposes. Is that correct?
That's about right. I mean, I could see, as I think I've said before, well, let me say, pretty much everything you said I agree with completely. The legislature could refer a tax just to raise money. It could refer a tax for one purpose. And the same analysis would apply to an initiative. The problem is when you start specifying unrelated purposes. I do think it might be possible under the single subject requirement to limit it to more than one fund or specific, limit the use of the revenue stream to more than one specific fund or type of thing, as long as there all those purposes are at least related to each other, which is why I probably had less of a problem with the housing initiative than with this, or they're related to the activity that you're taxing, and especially to impacts caused by that activity. So in some of the earlier severance tax ones, there was at least an argument to be made that, well, you're trying to offset some of the environmental costs or some of the costs when you extract a non-renewable resource from a local county. You're sort of taking away a resource that that county could use, and so you give money to the local government. But here you've got transportation that I don't think can be related to it. College scholarships, I think, clearly is not related to it. When you start doing that, as I said, there's no difference to me. Well, in fact, if there is a difference between that and someone coming in and saying, I want to slash spending for all these different types of programs, I don't see the difference from a single subject standpoint when you add in that, when you flip it around and say you're adding money to these. And in addition to that, you're creating a new tax, which itself has two purposes, which I think is perfectly fine. But the two purposes are both to increase the cost of oil and gas exploration and to raise money for the government, which that part I think is fine. But adding that on to the to changing how much money you spend on certain projects, certain state programs, I don't see how that solves a single subject problem. And so, yes, the answer to your question, I think, is yes. The problem I have is when you start dedicating streams to certain preferred projects that have nothing to do with each other or the activity being taxed, that to me is log rolling. And it's true that the log rolling isn't specifically prohibited, but what's prohibited is anything that practices like log rolling, and so I would think that that would be one of our more obvious ones. But as I said, it's not easy because you do run into difficulty sometimes, I think, drawing lines. But that's where I am. That the reason, the only reason really to throw this in is to get a coalition of groups together who might otherwise not support the tax. And so that's the problem, I think. And it really is, if you're going to have a single subject requirement, that's the reason to have it. Whether it's a good idea to have a single subject limit, I'm not sure, but we do.
And if you're correct, it does strike me that view of the single subject rule for initiatives would have to apply to the single subject rule for bills. And I don't see any difference, but and maybe it should. Maybe because the single subject rule for bills was intended to protect against such practices as log rolling as well. I think that would be a surprising result, but maybe that will be a result. With that discussion of the single subject issue, Mr. Gessler, would you like to continue with your motion for rehearing? And I might, by the way, just relating to what I said about single subject and what you're about to say, I am at this moment a little more inclined to go along with what I think is Mr. Domenico's position and throw in some percentages here, in part because I think it does potentially mitigate the potential log rolling issue if voters know the share of the pie, and that probably is not any accurate representation of Mr. Domenico's position, but I'm beginning to see at least some benefit in the titles to consider explaining what these sizes of the pieces of the pie are going to be. So, in any event, Mr. Gessler.
And I do want to thank the board very much. I mean, that was a very thorough discussion, and I do appreciate that. With respect to the size of the fiscal impact for the note, I've prepared an analysis similar but more refined than the one I provided approximately a month ago, and I do have exhibits for the board. I'll try and move through this in a brisk fashion, but please stop me if my reasoning does not make sense to you or if you have certain questions about it. So to begin with, if I may approach the board, I have three spreadsheets. Let me start with just one spreadsheet. So to begin with, this is the summary sheet of the calculations, and I have a couple backup sheets that explain the assumptions. But the general framework is this: the ad valorem tax. Currently, the initiative removes the ad valorem credit. The ad valorem credit is based on property taxes paid, and property taxes that are paid are based on the value of the oil or gas that are extracted. So, in other words, the value of the property, real property, is directly proportional to the value of the oil and gas that has been removed that year. So the way the tax works is that you have a valuation, for example, a 2005 valuation, and based on that valuation, you have certain taxes that are paid. And so what I have is a 2005 property valuation, and then taxes paid in 2006, which is $315 million. And so what I've done is put together the property valuations for 2005 through 2008, and those drive the taxes paid for 2006 through 2009. And the 2009 taxes are the ones that will actually be paid, property taxes that will be paid under the current regime for 2009, based on the 2008 values. What I did there is I allocated 92% of that to real property taxes. In other words, I removed the improvements and remove the personal property that form oil and gas property taxes, because the ad valorem tax credit only applies to real property. And then the ad valorem tax credit is only 87.5%. It's not 100% of the property taxes paid. So you only get an 87.5%. So I took 87.5% of that. And I like to stop right there so we can focus on the ad valorem, and then I'm happy to go to the stripper well. So the numbers, where I receive the numbers, if I may approach again, for the assessed values, I try to use government data in all instances here.
Can I just ask you a question before we get too deep into math? And avoiding the math is not my primary motivation for this, but is it your position that that whatever number that the number we put in there is irrelevant to the size of the tax that people will pay?
Yes. I know we've had this discussion before. My view on this is that if a certain tax is placed on the ballot initiative, that's the maximum amount that the state can collect, and any additional amount that it collects needs to be refunded. And I think the board has expressed, or members of the board at least, have expressed that opinion, that interpretation, which I agree with.
Well, then why do we care if why do we need to go into all this math?
Because it's the board's duty to do that.
No, it's not. If we put in $10 in there and they collect all this money, it just means that there's a pain in the... I mean, it's our duty to write in that first sentence how much more in taxes people are going to pay in the first year. And if we all are in agreement that it's a tautology, that whatever number we write in there is how much the taxes are going to go up in the year, then we don't have to get into the math, right?
Well, I would slightly disagree with you. Whatever number you put in there is a cap on how much the taxes go up and in the first year only. It's not how much they will go up. It's a cap on how much they can go up. And I think the reason why is that the purpose of this is to provide voters notice of the maximum amount that's going to be increased. I understand that members of the board have expressed the opinion that that the proponents can simply choose whatever number they desire and it goes in. I'm willing to address that right now if you want to listen to that before going into these.
Yeah, I mean, I really don't understand. If they wanted to come in and say, shall taxes be increased by $700 billion trillion, well, then that would, as you say, set the cap for how much in the first year it could be raised. And the reason that they would prefer not to do that is because it is a big, scary number. But if they put in a number that's too low, then... who cares? Then that just means that the cap will come into effect and the taxes will be raised by $321.4 million annually rather than this number you come up with. And so the number we put in there is, unless you come in and say it's really going to raise a lot less than this, then we might have an accuracy problem, but it's accurate as it's written, right? Unless the number comes in lower than that.
Well, I think the response is a couple-fold. First of all, the proponents do not have the right to come in here and put whatever number they want in. I don't think there's any statutory or constitutional authority that allows them to do that. If they want to do something like that, they could certainly write an initiative that says taxes will be increased by 5% and the ad valorem and the stripper well production, but no more than... and they choose their number. They do that as part of the initiative. They take that initiative, proposed initiative, to review and comment, where it provides public notice because the cap that they want to put on it is a substantive part of their proposal. It has to go through review and comment, and then it comes before a title board. But what essentially the approach to allow the proponents to put whatever number they choose in there, it allows them to make a substantive and a very substantive change or modification or perhaps an initial, however you want to characterize it, an initial draft of a very substantive provision of the initiative without going through review and comments, without going through review and comment, and without any authority that allows them, that authorizes them to be able to do that as part of the title board process. So I think that, you know, from that standpoint, I mean, first of all, it's unfair, I think, to other folks looking at this analysis to simply say, well, whatever the proponents do, and we'll spring that on them, you know, at the title board hearing, and the proponents can listen to what the Office of Legislative or OMPB says, or they can ignore what OMPB says, but it's up to them.
Well, but wait a minute. I might agree with you that it would be better to put the number in there at the beginning rather than at the end. But how does adopting your numbers result do anything better than that? I mean, we're just adopting. At least people have had 2 weeks to look at the other number. If we adopt your number, all of a sudden there's no opportunity beyond the next few minutes to comment on that number.
Well, I think that and perhaps I misconstrue the board's view on that, but I But I do believe that the board, we addressed this exact issue, that the board can consider additional analysis with respect to the fiscal impact number at a motion for rehearing for people who are on who don't believe that it's proper. And the motion for rehearing, the purpose of the motion for rehearing, is to provide notice to people to be able to respond to that. And we provided certainly the notice that we would be challenging this particular number at the motion for rehearing. I understand that was yesterday. That's in part due to the Constitution. But I believe it's a statutory mandate for an accelerated review process. Normally, this would be a two-week process that people would know what there's going to be a challenge to the actual number. And I think it's appropriate to be able to allow people to challenge that particular number and to have the title board review that matter. And along those lines, I would argue that it is the title board's responsibility to at least make a fair effort to put in an accurate number there as to what it's going to raise.
But what I'm saying is it is accurate, right? If it's going to raise, if the cap is 321.4 and it raises more than that, then there will be, the tax will stop being collected, or however it'll work, it'll be refunded. And so that number, essentially by definition, by operation of how Tabor works, is accurate.
Well, in that effort, I would argue that that particular argument's a tautology, that whatever is accurate is what the board chooses. I think the board needs to have some fair and reasonable standards for choosing what that number should be. It's not simply an arbitrary choice by the board saying, well, we think this particular matter, for example, a hypothetical in this instance, we think that the severance tax in this particular instance should only be raised by $100 million. Or we estimate, because we want to, that it'll be raised by $100 million. And it's accurate, so therefore we can do it, and there is no appropriate challenge because it's accurate.
Well, where do you get the authority for that we're obligated to pick the number that, to pick any other number? I mean, where's the authority that says we have to pick a number that's come up with by using your methodology versus using the OSPB's methodology, or by picking a number out of a hat, or by,
I believe it's inherent in the board's authority and responsibility to make good faith efforts to calculate what the tax is going to do and inform voters of that. And the purpose of the Tabor cap is to prevent the cap from being too high, or that number from being too high, because that was a policy decision incorporated into Tabor. But if you remember also in Tabor is that, and I'm sorry I don't have that in front of me, but I believe that the board should take the highest number that it thinks is reasonable. And now certainly the board is welcome to reject my analysis and say it's not reasonable, based on its thoughtfulness. But I do think that the board should, at a minimum, consider this, and at a minimum, and I understand that it's not fun being, analyzing economic analysis, but at a minimum, consider this matter, and at a minimum, use good faith efforts to provide an accurate number as to what they think that this is going to operate to do. And that the cap, in particular, is a notice provision, it's not something that grants proponents an unfettered ability to pick and choose whatever number they want, nor does it grant the title board, or does it change the title board's normal procedures of making a fair and honest effort to come up with the most accurate numbers that they can.
No, but it is accurate. It's a cap. It effectively caps the money, that the state can bring in. And that's what we do. We almost never get into trying to figure out what the effects of anything are going to be, which is what your analysis requires us to do, to say, well, if this, the valuations are going to be this. It really is a totally different procedure. Now, so obviously, I'm not going to agree with you on that point, but so maybe I'll move on to something that I think troubles me, and that is something I'd like to hear everybody discuss. It's not the first year issue, because I think whatever we put in there the first year is accurate, no matter what number it is, because it is a cap. I do wonder what happens after the first year, because the way these are written, it should just, I mean, if the language were taken literally, that cap of 321.4 or whatever number we put in there would not just apply the first year. It would be a cap effectively forever. And that, I don't know, is how, I don't believe that's how Tabor votes are typically interpreted. And so that's where I'm curious if you might be able to convince me that we have a problem using that number, because it implies that it will never, not only in the first year, but it will never go above that amount. And maybe I'm wrong, and maybe that is how it should be interpreted. But does anybody, maybe it's better to ask the proponents how much they think they'll be allowed to take in future years, given the numbers we use, because I'm not clear on that. And that does really cause me a lot of the problems you've brought up, that maybe if that isn't really a cap, an annual cap, but just a one-time cap, then I do have a problem with it.
Ms. Eubanks, would you like to comment?
And I don't know that I'll be very helpful. As far as I know, there hasn't been any judicial interpretation of the provision, so in terms of everyone having their own opinions of what this means, but the provision that's at issue here in Tabor, which is in subsection 3C, where it has the mandatory ballot language where you have to fill in the blank, it starts out, that provision starts out by saying, except by later voter approval, if a tax increase or fiscal year spending exceeds any estimate in B3, which is the estimate that's actually in the notice that has to be sent out, which I assume would probably be based on the estimate that's in your ballot language. It says if it exceeds that amount for the same fiscal year, the tax increase is thereafter reduced up to 100% in proportion to the combined dollar excess and the combined excess revenue refunded in the next fiscal year. So in terms of, and this is only my guess of how this would work, but the reason why the ballot language talks about first or a phased in final full fiscal year dollar increase is that first year you have a number, and whether it's, you know, 321 million, and if the revenue comes in above that amount, then this other provision of Tabor requires the tax rate, the 5%, let's say in this measure, to be reduced so that it's actually only producing the 321 million. I mean, in
forever.
Theory, in theory, right. And so that's sort of my understanding. Now, the other aspect of that is that when you look at the spending limits for the state, for locals, whatever, basically get your previous fiscal year spending adjusted for growth, which for the state is population and inflation, plus voter-approved revenue changes. And at least it's my perspective that voter-approved revenue changes don't get adjusted by the growth factors. Mm-hmm. So it's only your fiscal year spending, and so voter-approved revenue change is that dollar amount. So I think in theory that's at least one way it could work. How it works out in the real world, and whether anybody's ever run into this in terms of, I don't think from the state perspective I'm aware of that, as to whether any local government has ever had this come into play, I don't know. But that's what it says, so I think at least that's one theory of how you get to that dollar amount in the out years, is because it says if you're generating more that first year, then you have to reduce your tax rate in order to generate the amount that you said.
And it's hard to read Tabor, and especially hard to read the required ballot language in Tabor as allowing anything else other than that. I mean, I don't see how you could say shall taxes be increased by any number we put in there, however we arrived at it, and allow it to, unless you added some additional language saying it can be increased for inflation and whatnot, which would be hard to do, but maybe possible. My interpretation is that that would be a cap in perpetuity, and if you wanted to raise more money than this number annually, you'd have to have another measure, which I'm not sure makes Mr. Ramey happy, and I'm not sure it makes Mr. Gessler happy, because it means I'm still right back where I was, which is whatever number we put in there is accurate by the fact that we put it in there, and it reinforces why that's true, because it puts Mr. Ramey in a difficult position, because if that's a hard cap, then he can pick what number he wants in there, and if he picks too low in order to make it easier to pass, then he runs up against this perpetual cap, and if he picks too high, then perhaps he'll be voted down, and I have difficult, and so in that sense, Tabor in its strange way makes sense, and it's hard to make sense of it any other way, but that's sort of where I am on that.
I'll yield the podium to Mr. Ramey, but I will, with the board's permission, at least perhaps continue the discussion about whether he has the right to, or any proponent has the right to simply choose what cap it desires.
Mr. Ramey?
Mr. Chair, I just... don't worry about it. It's okay. independently, and I feel actually good about this, my interpretation is quite similar to Ms. Eubanks. And the board can take me on faith. I didn't just decide that. Actually kind of reached the same conclusion, struggling with the language of Tabor. I think what Tabor would require us to do if we are low in this estimate is A, a refund, and B, an adjustment of the tax rate. That's the thing that makes sense, which will have an effect on a going forward basis. I'm aware of no decisions that have said that. I'm aware of no situation where this has come up before any court to date. I suppose someday it will. And how you adjust the tax, I would say I'm not quite sure that's particularly clear. Do you adjust the rate? Do you adjust, in our particular case, the removal of the ad valorem credit? Do you do something else? Do we have the option? At this stage, I don't know. But I think there is a going forward effect that our underestimating would cause. I think that's the only logical way to read Tabor, and I guess I agree with Mr. Domenico on that as well. I don't see 321.4 as becoming a cap, in that then the second year 321.4 is a cap, and the third year it is. But I'd like to defer that discussion. I think we're in a bit of a moot scenario right here, because we don't really have a factual situation posed. But there is a consequence to the proponents of being low. Having said that, I am not suggesting to the board, and maybe Mr. Domenico is right, we could come in here with any estimate we want. We could read tea leaves and come in with an estimate. I'm not going to argue that the proponents don't have the responsibility of behaving in good faith before the board, and the board doesn't have the responsibility of having some rationale, arguably, hopefully accepting the... referring to the proponents to some degree with regard to that number, bearing in mind the consequences that the proponents shoulder by being off on their number. Also having said that, I would request that the board, and this may be the last thing you want to hear from me, permit Mr. Gessler to complete his presentation, however the board may feel about this particular issue. He has gone to some effort. We have obviously adopted the upper end of a fairly large continuum that the Office of State Planning and Budgeting proposed. We took their top number with quite a spread that they presented as possible outcomes of the first year's tax. But I think Mr. Gessler should be permitted to put his rationale on the record, at least whatever the board decides to do with it, and not be prohibited from doing that.
Can I ask you one question? I think you skipped over what my big question is, which is what happens in the years 2 through infinity. Because to me, if that number doesn't apply annually, then how do we set an annually? To me, means annually means more than just the first year. How do we write an accurate? How can any number we put in there be accurate if the tax will increase $321.4 million the first year and $400 million the second year, or $645 million the second year? How is that title accurate if that's what Tabor is taken to mean?
Mr. Domenico, all I can do is guess, as Ms. Eubank says that she was doing, and I think all of us can do, because I don't know of any, if this has ever been addressed in a judicial forum as yet. My guess, and it's purely a guess, it's no better than yours or anybody else's in the room, my guess is that we would be required to lower the tax in some fashion or another. In addition to refunding the overage the first year, we would be required to lower the tax so that it would have generated the number that we predicted that first year, and then the tax stays.
Okay, so you're basically...
Now, that is a guess, and someday I may argue...
I'm sure.
I may argue a different position.
Well, and I may end up having to defend a different position in court myself. But the question, I guess, is it really the intent of the proponents to raise more than that number in the future? Or... do they intend, because then I really do have a problem with a low estimate and would want to err on a really high estimate because it would be misleading otherwise. And everything I've said about you guys being able to pick whatever number you want, I would have to retract because I think it really is misleading if that's what we're saying. And so I guess that's my question is, do you intend to raise more than $321.4 million in any year?
Mr. Domenico, I mean, that question can't be answered because that is dependent upon the revenue that's produced by the production of oil and gas in the state, which we have no control over. That presumably, responding to all sorts of national, international, and local variables, will go up and down and vary in all sorts of different ways. It is not our intent to do anything surreptitious here. It is our intent to impose a tax with a rate that we have stated, eliminating a credit, eliminating or reducing various exemptions, and then having that tax, as we have structured it, apply to whatever the income from the severance of oil and gas in this state happens to be. Now, that number, I have no expectation that would stay at $321.4 million or any number that Mr. Gessler may come up with or any other number at all. It may go up, it may go down. It depends upon a lot of things that the structure of this tax is not designed to control. But what we are attempting, what I'm trying to say is, in the first year, I think what Tabor does is say that if we come in the first year with more revenue than we have estimated, A, we have to refund it. B, we then have to lower the tax in some fashion or another so that the tax would have produced that amount, the number that we estimated the first year. And from there on, the tax is the tax.
So that's just a one-time...
No.
Adjustment.
Well, no. Well, it's a one-time adjustment of the tax, but its effect carries forward in the future, barring further voter choice.
So what you're saying is if it turns out that you needed to raise 321, you only needed a 3% income, or however, I understand there may be other ways to do it, that then you would refund any extra money and the new tax would somehow be adjusted so that it would have in the first year raised this number that we put in here. And then there's no more adjusting ever again. That whatever it brings in, it brings in.
Yes, based upon all the other variable factors as to the income that the producers
right.
and royalty owners would be receiving. They're being taxed at a particular rate of their income, subject to the various other provisions of this proposal. Now, I may be absolutely dead wrong about that. I wish I could cite an opinion, Mr. Domenico, to you. There is none. And someday, in some context, hopefully not this tax, I'm sure we'll all be educated on that. But the important point is that I think the only fair way to read Tabor is not just that we do a refund the first year, and then we just go back to whatever we were doing before, and we can rake in massive amounts of money inconsistent with the estimate that we provided the first year. I don't think Tabor would be applied that way. I don't think that's a fair reading of Tabor, but that is a guess. Maybe a court will decide that is a fair reading of Tabor. If that's the case, I don't know what to do.
Well, I don't think that's a fair reading of it. But the third way, the way I'm reading it, and it's really based sort of on this language that we're forced to put in here, is that that it is a permanent cap on how much. Because I don't know how we can write an accurate title that conveys that taxes will be increased by $321.4 million the first year and then by some other number.
Well, Tabor does say, and I agree with you, the wording of Tabor and the wording of that language that the board is required to use and we're required to adopt is not optimal. But it does, that number is stated to be a first-year estimate. And we're having to live with that. I don't think it means that that number becomes a cap forever, so that the first-year estimate becomes a ceiling no matter what the income of the producers and royalty owners, taxpayers in this case, would be. But again, the unfortunate thing about this discussion is all of us can go round and round about this, and I'm not sure we can answer it. The one thing I think is clear, it's not just a first-year penalty. It's not just, I don't think it's a fair reading to say we refund the first year and then we all forget about it. No, there is an ongoing consequence of some sort. Someday we'll learn what it is. Again, having said that, I guess I would ask the board's patience or permission that Mr. Gensler to make his presentation, because that may be a factual basis if this turns out to be the tax where that becomes relevant.
And I think from my perspective, I think we are driven by the language of Tabor that says we have to fill in a blank that is the first full fiscal year. It sounds like there's questions about what happens thereafter, but it seems to me the number for us to use is the first full fiscal year dollar increase. That's the language of Tabor. And I mean, with an exception being that if a tax is phased in, then it's the final year of the phase in. But that, I don't think that's the situation in this particular measure. So to me, the board has to fill in a number that is the first full fiscal year dollar increase. Now, I am, unless I'm missing something, so somebody probably can correct me here, as far as how we get that number, which is another very critical thing that I think Mr. Domenico is raising, it seems to me that we have an obligation to fill that number in based on the language of the measure, like the rest of the title. I think we're driven by the language of the measure, and we know that, and as opposed to what the proponents say it is, I don't think that drives it necessarily. I think we have an independent obligation to make a good faith estimate of what the measure itself will produce in revenue in the first full fiscal year. Now, I also know that I have no way of knowing that. I mean, just typically, it's where would we as board members start to figure out that kind of thing? And I think we can turn to any reliable source or multiple sources where there may be competing estimates. I think proponents, opponents, and the Office of State Planning and Budgeting can all come to different results based on good analysis. And then I think the board is obligated to in good faith, adopt what appears to be a reasonable estimate. Like other questions involved in the meaning of a measure, I personally am influenced by what the proponents believe to be the effect of their measure. And there's some support in the case law that the statements made on the record become relevant. But in this particular case, I recognize that, in fact, it's more than that. It's not just like the other provisions of the title where we're trying to guess at what it does. Here, there really is a consequence under Tabor to the number we pick. But I don't focus on the self-fulfilling prophecy that we can say $10 or something else, and then it becomes true. I think we have to look at it in terms of what the measure itself provides. And maybe I'm beating a dead horse here, but I just don't believe it would be right for proponents to draft a measure that raises, say, $500 million a year in revenue, and then later decide that that's not palatable and come into the title board and say, we want you to put in $100 million. I think the comments earlier that they ought to amend their measure to say that. I on the one hand, I'm very much influenced by what the proponents want because of the consequences. The proponents are in the best position to balance competing considerations that, on the one hand, they probably want to maximize the revenue for their intended purposes, but at the same time, sensitive to the fact that the higher the revenue, the maybe the harder for voters to approve it, which is, I think, why Tabor wants it right up front. And so I think I really do rely on the proponent's view of the estimates. But I believe we're obligated to make an independent assessment of the evidence in front of us.
Mr. Hobbs, may I just responding to that? I would advise the board that frankly, the proponents thought the figure would be lower than this. And if without the OSPB estimate we had been asked, I would have had a lower number for you. Not that I was trying to engage in a political maneuver, but we really thought by our analysis the number would be lower. I can also advise the board that among people with whom the proponents have consulted, the range of possible numbers covers the gamut, though most of them are lower than the 321.4 that we are using now. This number came because, in addition to our own analyses, we looked at the estimate of the Office of State Planning and Budgeting, and they gave us a range. And I don't have it in front of me right now, but I think it was something about $100 million lower than the 321.4, 90-some million dollars lower, up to the 321.4, and we decided, notwithstanding perhaps the political ramification, having a higher number in there, that we would go with the highest number in the OSPB range. So I say that not to necessarily justify that number vis-a-vis whatever number Mr. Gessler is about to present, but to say that it has been presented in. And I would agree, Mr. Chair, that I think the proponents have. I guess the proponents should be expected to present the board with a number that makes sense. And I think the board does have an obligation to engage in some level of a reasonable analysis, bearing in mind that in this particular case, even OSPB said this is really a hard estimate to make. And it's due to all the variable factors that come into play when you're dealing with revenue from the production of oil and gas. So we do the best we can, but I think it can be presumed we all approach it in good faith.
Thank you.
Well, all this just highlights why I think that it's got to be interpreted as some kind of a true cap, because otherwise we're just throwing numbers around, and there are dozens of good faith numbers we could come up with. We could, I think, adopt a rule that we're just going to automatically take the OSPB's number, and if they give a range, we'll take the middle of that range. Because none of us has any reason to choose that number over Mr. Gessler's or vice versa, or the proponents, if they'd come in with their own lower estimate. There's no reason to justify it. The only reason to put any number in there is that it's a hard number that the state can't collect any more money that goes above that number. Now, if, and I appreciate that Mr. Ramey has come up, has got sort of a middle approach to it, in that 321.4 million annually means 321.4 million annually, and then you adjust all the future calculations so that they're based on, so that they would have raised that amount in the first place. That at least eliminates the difficulty somewhat. Actually, it eliminates, I think, entirely the difficulty of us trying to figure out whose estimate is best. But what it doesn't do is make the title accurate, because you're raising the tax by more than 321.4, or maybe less, depending on the year. And maybe it seems to me that it, I know we're stuck with that language from Tabor, but if that's what we're going to say, and that's not a hard cap, a perpetual cap, then I think we need to say that in the title. I mean, I can't vote for a title that says, shall we raise taxes by X dollars when annually, when we're only raising taxes by X dollars in 2009, and in future years we're raising it by whatever number we happen to come up with. I mean, that, I don't know how I can discharge my duty to tell people accurately what they're voting on if that's the case.
Mr. Chair, I mean, I respectfully do have a problem if the board starts messing around with language requirements of Tabor. I would concur, Mr. Domenico, with you completely that the language of Tabor and the language that Tabor requires be used here is not optimal. I would respectfully request the board strenuously, because I have no opportunity really beyond today to deal with this, but don't start changing what Tabor requires you to do in the context of this initiative. I mean, that will kill this initiative. It will be, I think, an extra jurisdictional act by this board, and I would strongly request you not do that. Now, you raise an extremely important issue, Mr. Domenico, as to what the future consequences should be, and I do think that is not ripe before us today. Someday we are going to have to face that issue, hopefully sooner than later, hopefully not in the context of this initiative, though maybe we should be so blessed as to have that happen with this initiative. But we don't have the answer to the question that you are raising yet. We've done our best, not only in terms of, we're doing our best to come up with a number, but we've done our best to speculate as to the consequences of being wrong. But I don't think we should be going beyond that, given the charge that this board has under a constitutional provision that is Tabor.
No, I wouldn't suggest that we change the required language. The only way to try to deal with it would be to add some language later, after the required language, that makes clear what's going on. I certainly agree that it would be a mistake to...
We don't know what's going on. That's, I don't know how we...
Well, right. I mean, the only way we know what's going on, and the only way, I mean, what is in front of me and the board today is that we're required to set a title that accurately tells people what they're voting on. And one easy, the easy way to do that is to interpret the Tabor language as a perpetual cap. If we're not going to interpret it as a perpetual cap, then we run into real difficulties, and I don't know what to do if that's the way it's interpreted.
But how is that not involving us in determining future effects of the measure?
All I know is I'm being asked to vote to set an accurate title, and I'm also required to vote on something that says state taxes shall be increased 321.4 million annually. So to me, the only way I can do both of those things is to interpret that annually as meaning annually, meaning every year. And if that's the interpretation, I'm fine. If it's not the interpretation, then I don't know what I'm, I don't know how we can set an accurate title. So I guess that's my point, is if that's not the interpretation, we really do have some difficulty in trying to both discharge our duty and not involve ourselves in extensive interpretation. But I don't know how else to comply with Tabor and set an accurate title than to interpret that as a cap.
Well, I guess I'm just viewing this as Tabor dictates that language as unsatisfactory as it may be because of these concerns, and until some court addresses what the future effects are, I'm not sure why the board is compelled to go on and, because Tabor requires a number, why the board is then required to make a determination as to what Tabor will drive in future years.
Because we're required to set an accurate title, and if everybody is in agreement that this will in future years raise $500 million or $1 billion or $323 million, then we're not setting an accurate title because it discusses how much taxes shall be increased annually.
That what Tabor requires us to do?
Tabor requires us to put that number in there. We also have an obligation to set an accurate title. And so simply because Tabor tells us to put a certain number in there doesn't mean, I don't see how we can say that that means we don't also have to accurately tell people. And so maybe we just leave that number in there and I justify it by saying, well, the only reasonable way to square Tabor's requirements with that requirement of an accurate title is that it'll have to be interpreted as a perpetual cap. And I guess that's fine with me, but nobody else seems to share that interpretation, in which case it seems to me we're misleading people.
And I don't think I know the answer to the questions that you're raising. What I'm seeing is that Tabor says the first full fiscal year is the annual increase. I'm not agreeing with that. I'm just saying that's what Tabor dictates. It, to me, that's kind of an anomaly. That's kind of contradictory to say that the first year is the annual increase.
I agree, and the only way to make it make any sense is, as I've said, to make it a permanent cap, and so that's the difficulty.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Ramey?
Mr. Chair, I don't mean to belabor this point. I guess two observations. Number one, with regard to severance tax in particular, and this may not be true of all taxes, that the amount of revenue, let's assume we're dead on, first year we come in with $321.4 million, precisely as predicted. It is anticipated revenue from severance tax will eventually go down. So ultimately, this number is going to be high. And eventually, the extraction of oil and gas will go away, and there are different predictions as to how quick that will happen. So this isn't just a question of potentially underestimating, it's overestimating. Secondly, Mr. Domenico, while again I share your concern, I don't know how you ever set a Tabor title, a title on a Tabor measure, if we do what you're suggesting should be done. Having said that, I appreciate the making of the record here today, because I think some of the concerns that you've expressed are highly legitimate and valid. It's just that it's a problem we can't solve, and the title board can't solve. It's a problem that needs to be addressed in another capacity. Virtually anything you do, not only in terms of changing this language, but if you do something later in the measure, even with the proponents and the opponents' concurrence, that dilutes or changes or indirectly affects the impact of that first language, I would suggest you violated Article 10, Section 20. And exceeded the jurisdiction of the board. You can't do that, notwithstanding the legitimacy of the concerns you're raising. So, I would ask the board don't go there. Someday we'll get this sorted out, but not in this context.
Yeah, I think now that I think about it, I think you're right about that. I think it would be a mistake to try to explain the other interpretation of it in there. Now, I do think that if somehow, if one day we do get an interpretation that says, well, annually really is just kind of doesn't really mean an annual cap, then maybe in the future we would, in future measures, explain that somehow later. But I think you're right that for now that's too much kind of us putting our own spin, as you say, even if everybody agreed with it. And so I think you're right. We probably should just leave that as it is and have the fight later.
Shall we return to Mr. Gessler's presentation of his fiscal information? I don't know how speedy he was intending to be, but given the hour, I'm hoping it's fairly speedy.
I will do my best to make a quick audition as an oil and gas economist. I will try to move through this pretty quickly. Just starting back, property valuations are based upon the value of the oil and gas extracted, and so they operate in tandem with oil and gas prices. Property taxes are of course based upon the property valuations. And what I think I handed the board was property valuations for 2005, 2006, and 2007, based from the Department of Local Affairs. Those are published government documents. So from that, we get 2005, 2006, 2007. What we need to do here to accurately identify what the value is of the property, and therefore the property taxes paid, we have to project what the property valuation will be for 2008. So what you have there is the projection. I'll explain how that works. Then what we do is we get the taxes, property taxes paid for 2009. Of those property taxes, 92% is allocated to real property taxes. And the ad valorem credit applies only to 87.5% of that. So the ad valorem credit or projected 2009 that people would get, that oil and gas companies would get would be based on $536,998,551. Does that make sense? So to explain some of my assumptions, you have in front of you the assumptions for the property tax valuations for 2005 through 2007. The next item is the taxes paid. Taxes paid is based upon a oil and gas economic impact produced by the Colorado Energy and Research Institute, Colorado School of Mines. This is the same document I passed out a few weeks ago. I'm also going to provide the board the full. I provided an excerpt. Here's the full analysis. I'll give you this one instead. And basically, if you look on page, the third sheet, Roman numeral 12, the tax revenue based on the 2005 property valuation was $315 million. And if you turn to the next page, that's page 57 of the report. Basically what it says is that number, that $315 million, is based upon the 2005 valuation, but it was deflated to produce it in 2005 dollars rather than in 2006 dollars. So in fact, the 2006 taxes actually paid were a little bit higher than the $315 million, because that $315 million represents the 2006 taxes less the inflation rate from 2005 to 2006. So just to explain the approach there. So what I did then is basically take that proportion, the $5 billion property valuation that resulted in $315 million property taxes paid, and extrapolated that same rate for the future. So based upon that rate, by 2008, $10 billion valuation will result, using the same rate, $667 million in property taxes paid. Then the 92% allocation of property taxes, I based that upon the 2006 report to the Governor and General Assembly, if I may throw it. And what this number is, if I've included sort of the table of contents, and the important page to look at is from the counting from the back, and I'm sorry, this isn't numbered, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, seventh page from the end, okay? And it has, and it's entitled 2006 Abstract Data by Type of Property. It has oil and gas land, oil and gas improvements, oil and gas personal property, those categories. Obviously, it includes vacant land and the other categories, but I'm focusing on the oil and gas. And so basically, what I did is I took those numbers and derived, calculated that 92% is based on land, and the other 8% is based on improvements in personal property. So what I did then is basically take that number, the 92%, and I allocated of the $667 million in 2009 or the $315 million in 2006, took 92% of that number. Say that's the number that represents the real property to which the ad valorem credit applies. And then I simply multiplied that by 87.5%. So this represents the credit against the severance taxes that the that oil and gas companies received. Now, to explain some of the other assumptions in there, the next item is the gas pricing, and I have another spreadsheet. And if the board remembers correctly, what I did is I sort of used a benchmark of spot oil prices to identify the percentage increases. I think that's incorrect because most of what in Colorado is produced is natural gas as opposed to oil. And what I did here is to come up with that property valuation number. Okay, what I did is I identified the percentage increase from 2007 to 2008, the percentage increase in the value of all of the production in Colorado, and then I applied that same percentage increase to the 2007 property valuation to result in the 2008 valuation. And these are my numbers. For the gas pricing, the Colorado average was $5.10 in 2007, and the projected is 6.9%. 2008, that's a 35% increase. Actual, the production, these are taken from actual numbers for 2007. 2008, I projected that the 2008 level of production would equal the 2006 level of production. That's based on two factors. The first is that the 2007 level productions were slightly depressed due to pipeline problems and transportation problems, and that there had been a massive number of well permitting and additional drilling that's going on. So I simply said that 2008 will climb back up to the 2006 numbers. And then I simply multiply the average price per MCF times the production to get me a value, the dollar amount produced. That's the gross income. I did the same thing with oil pricing. I took the Colorado average for 2007, those are actual numbers, and then projected to 2008 based on the West Texas estimated increase benchmark, and I'll show you what that is in a moment. I show you what the West Texas is, and the percentage change was 51%. So I basically applied the 51% price increase to the 2007 Colorado average in order to get to the 2008 Colorado average. I again took actual production numbers for 2007 and actual production numbers for 2006, which I inserted for 2008, okay, and came up with the value of oil production here in Colorado. The total, I simply added the gas plus the oil, and I came up with the 2007 and the 2008. That number is a 48% increase in production value. That 48% increase, actually I added a significant digit to the first spreadsheet. That's the 48.2% there. That's how I derived that number in order to move from the 2007 to 2008. Below that, on the sheet I handed you, is the proportion of real and personal property from 2006. The 2006 property valuations, that 92% blend, this is just the math. I copied those numbers from that spreadsheet to identify that. The last items I have are basically the numbers that I use to project the actual prices for the future 2008 cost for oil and gas. So this is the spreadsheet here, and what I did, I'll explain it first and then provide the backup documentation, is I took from the EIA, that's the Energy Information Agency from the United States, as part of the United States government, I basically identified these are the 2004 through 2007 numbers are national wellhead averages. And then the 2008 number is the short-term estimated energy outlook for the national average wellhead prices. And that provides me with a magnitude of increase on a national level of 35%. Based on that, I'm assuming that Colorado will rise in proportion to the national increases. In fact, Colorado will probably rise greater, more than that, because there's recently a pipeline that was completed, or a large portion of the pipeline that was completed. That's allowing Colorado to deliver its energy, its natural gas, more efficiently to Midwestern markets. So that's going to substantially increase the price of Colorado gas. What I did next is I produced the published Colorado gas prices. These are from the Colorado Conservation and Oil and Gas Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. The 2004 for 2007 are actual prices. The 2008, that's 6.90, is estimated on the 35%. I think this number is conservative, again, because of that pipeline. And you can see how the Colorado published prices substantially dropped, a lot more than national prices. I will note that, and I can attest to this from personal experience, that the published gas prices only account for a small portion, and that oil and gas companies are truly very hesitant to provide what the actual prices are they pay, even when some of those are connected to your client. So actually getting those numbers is sometimes challenging. The third number is the NYMEX. That's a New York Mercantile Exchange numbers. And those are based upon projected numbers. The $7.48 from 2007, that was the projected contracts for projected prices in December of 2007. That's the highest number. The 2008, that was last week's contractual price, estimating what the prices are going to be for July. What I did is I used the the NYMEX as sort of a benchmark to say, okay, is my 35% number crazy? And in fact, compared to the NYMEX and what traders are planning on, the 35% number is a little bit more conservative. For the Colorado actual, for the cost per barrel, what I did for 2007 and 2008, I compared the first 4 months of 2007 and 2008. Those are actual numbers. Those aren't estimates. Or those aren't derivations. Those are actual numbers from the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. You can see that currently in April, last month, it was $106 per barrel at the wellhead the Colorado producers were getting. I did two projections. I took the West Texas crude standard. That's $72 in 2007. And it's estimated to be in 2008 $109. That's a 51% increase. I simply applied that percentage increase to the Colorado average, brings it from $65 to $93. As you can see, both March and April have already exceeded that average number that I'm using for the Colorado average for 2008. So again, that's a reality check. If anything, that Colorado average is probably low. Okay. The backup numbers for that, I'll pass out. Not inundating the board with paper. I've got four items that I'll hand the board for the natural gas price backup. And again, this is all government data that I'm relying on here. The first item is just a graph showing forecast, and it gives you a composite wellhead price. That's the composite well price I used. You can just generally see how that the bottom line is the composite wellhead price. There are other standards. For example, the residential price is more volatile. But you can see in general that those natural gas prices are pretty much on target. The next item I handed was the Energy Information Administration. This provides actual measurement data from the U.S. from the U.S. Energy Information, U.S. Governmental Statistics. It provides year 5 and year 6 numbers, 2005, 2006. It doesn't have 2007 numbers, so it is a little bit limited. But it does give you a sense of actually what the actual prices were. The next item is the production numbers. These are monthly coal bed and conventional natural gas produced by county. These are actual numbers for 2007, 2006, and there's a little bit of 2005 that unfortunately does not print out very well based on the website. And then finally are the published gas prices, and the final column on the right is the Colorado Gas Price Index. That's dollars per 1,000 cubic feet. That's the proper comparison. The other ones are based on dollars per 100,000, I believe it's per 100,000 BTUs. That's a different measurement. So the one on the right, those are the actual. You can see starting December of 08, December of 07 and onward, we don't have actual reported data for Colorado, but we do have that reported data. So when I say that these are actual measurement numbers, this is based on the COGCC numbers. That's my backup for, I mean, that's what I derived those numbers for the natural gas increases and how I estimated the 2008. With respect to crude oil, again, crude oil is around, you know, a little bit under 20% of total value, but we still have to look at it. This is the general forecast. And it gives you the West Texas Intermediate price. I use that as a benchmark because it's a national benchmark for domestically produced oil that provides a sense of the magnitude of increase. That's how I got the 51% increase that I used to extrapolate for Colorado. The next item is the U.S. Energy Information Administration. Those are some, and it shows U.S. energy nominal prices. That basically means in non-adjusted, non-inflated dollars. So these are the actual dollars that people pay. Crude oil prices, it shows you the West Texas averages for 2006, 2007, and it goes to 2008. That's where I got the magnitude of increase. If you average out all these months in the crude oil price graph I handed you, you'll get the same thing. The next page is the Colorado, actual measured Colorado numbers. And you can see we have a lot more in oil and gas for oil than we do for gas. Oil, we have actual measurements. If you look in the bolded column, January through April of this year. So you can actually see this year's prices. So our numbers are less, we have a much better reality check. And then the last one, remember I said I added up the actual amount that was produced by the state in those years, and that's what we get for the actual production for 2007, 2006, and 2005. There's a slight variation. We did some analysis where basically we took the monthly price times the monthly production and added those up rather than the average price times the total production. It was an absolute minimal change. So I didn't want to swamp the board with that. What that does is that produces the overall percentage increase for the oil, percentage increase for the gas. We have production estimates for the oil, production numbers for the gas. That gives us our total produced value. Total produced value, we show a percentage increase. We apply that percentage increase to the property valuations and then from that extrapolate what the severance tax ad valorem credit will be. If you go back to the very first page, that comes up with a $536 million number. For the stripper well exemption, all that I did is I took the stripper well production amounts, and those are based on the percentage of production in Colorado based on stripper wells. Those are 2006 numbers that I obtained from Colorado Legislative Council staff. And basically, if you look at page 7 of that report, it shows share of wells and production from stripper wells. It's spelled striper in my view, but I'm wrong in the spelling. But for 2006, it shows oil production was 59.7% from stripper wells, natural gas production 20.4%. Okay, so I looked at the total production value. I multiplied it by the production, which gave me the stripper well production value for 2008. Okay, for both the oil and gas, I added those two together. I basically assumed that half of the stripper wells will lose their exemption and half will keep them. Currently, a stripper well is 15 barrels per day or less, and the new exemption will basically say stripper wells are exempt at 7.5 per day less. So I took that median number, 7.5. I assumed half above, half below. So I said there's a 50% loss on the exemption. So in other words, the total stripper well production, we have to reduce that by half. I multiplied it by the 5% rate that's going to be applied to that portion of production now. And that gave me 78 million. Below that, all that I did is I did a reality check. I compared the estimate, the OSPB estimate for Initiative 113, which we have here. I compared that to the estimate for Initiative 88, which, as I remember correctly, and I could be incorrect, and I'm happy to be disabused of this notion, Initiative 88 only removed the ad valorem tax. It didn't touch the stripper well exempt. So in other words, 113 is the ad valorem removal plus the stripper well change. So I'm basically isolating the stripper well change. That comes out to about $108.1 million. That's a rough estimate. Okay, and I recognize that, but I basically used that as a reality check to make sure that my $78 million number wasn't crazy. And I compared that to the OSPB numbers for their stripper. Unfortunately, stripper wells, the data is exceedingly difficult to identify and use, and I couldn't find, I thought, reliable and usable government sources to be able to provide to this board, so this is my analysis. So basically, it comes up for the total tax increase on the industry. I took the ad valorem. I added the stripper well portion to it. I used a low end of the stripper well number that I came up with, a high end of the difference between the 321 and the 213. And I understand that 321 itself represents the high end of an estimate. I recognize that. So that's why I just put together a range of $615 million to $645 million total. I'm happy to answer any questions, and I tried to be brief as possible, and I apologize for that lengthy economic analysis.
Ms. Eubanks.
I have a couple of questions. The first is in terms of timing, and this is in regard to the removal of the ad valorem credit. In terms of the timing of, for a property tax year, the production for that property tax year, I mean, then they get a bill the following property tax year for the production. So, for example, for production in 2007, a producer would get a bill in 2008, which then is used as the basis for the credit, the ad valorem credit for against their production in 2008 is. Am I understand? I'm just trying to get the time sequence so that your numbers make sense to me.
No, I understand exactly your question. I don't know the exact answer to that. What I'm basing it on is the CERI analysis, which seemed to indicate that there was a very solid $315 million that people paid in 2006, and then that was based on those 2005 numbers, that 2005 valuation. I also looked at that. If you look at the 2007 assessments, the sheet that I handed out, that was actually, if you look at the bottom of that sheet, it was prepared in January of 2008. So it seems as though it's a very quick turnaround, and there isn't that much of a lag as we would normally face with, for example, residential property taxes. So that was my assumption, and I recognize I could be wrong. If I am on that, you know, the 2008 number would actually be the 2009 number, so we would have 362,000 plus the 362 million plus the 78 to 108. So I'm trying to be transparent in the analysis, but that was my assumption, and that was how I analyzed it.
In terms of the numbers that you have given us, in terms of your estimate of the impact of repealing the ad valorem credit as well as the stripper well, do the numbers that you've provided take into account the fact that this initiative doesn't impose any tax until you hit the $300,000 gross income threshold? So did you make any, I mean, because I don't know for a fact, but I assume that there may be stripper wells that, although their production is as you've stated, and you take half of that away in terms of being exempt, still if they haven't hit the $300,000 gross income threshold for imposition of the tax, they still wouldn't be taxed.
I didn't go into quite that level of granularity. My assumption is this, that the production of the ad valorem is, the production of stripper wells is obviously very closely connected to the value that it receives. And likewise, what we're doing is we're facing in 2008 far higher oil prices. So to the extent there is that uncertainty, stripper wells themselves, even if they produce the exact amount, we're going to have stripper wells that exceed the $300,000 for the same production in 2008, a substantial number that didn't exceed that $300,000 in the past. And likewise, this doesn't take into account the anticipated increased well production because of the higher prices and the increased number of stripper wells. I don't have those exact numbers. I don't know if they're even possible to get. But I do think that some of these uncertainties here tend to balance one another out. And again, that's why in some of these instances I took a more conservative approach than a higher approach on this.
Okay. In terms of the fiscal note that we had received from OSPB on this initiative, and it talks about a lot of, you know, difficulties of not having this type of data specifically. I mean, it basically said that the total value of all ad valorem tax credits and small well exemption is not tracked by the Department of Revenue, blah, 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 so it isn't really possible. They were making the statement that it wasn't possible for them to very accurately come up with an estimate. So based on all this information, you've come up with these estimates. Can you tell me why they wouldn't have been able to do that?
I think what they should have done is look at the SERI analysis. And really what it comes, one of the foundations of the analysis is this Colorado Energy Research Institute analysis. And it's produced by the Colorado School of Mines. That's why I provide the entire copy there. And if you look at this analysis, they do a lot of work in order to track the property taxes collected. And so even though the Department of Revenue doesn't track that, this organization did. So at a minimum, if you look at the 2006 taxes and you run through these calculations, which I feel very good about, because those don't require an extrapolation, those don't require estimates for future oil prices. It's a hard measurement of the taxes, the property taxes that were paid in 2006 based on 2005 numbers. And that 92% valuation is based on a 2006 department analysis. So it's not far off from the actual 2005 numbers. And the 87.5% credit hasn't changed. And even that number comes out to the $253 million amount. And then if you look at the change from 2005 to 2006, at a minimum there, we're looking at a 45% increase. So unless the actual tax rates for property taxes just collapse by 45%, you're going to see a continual 45% increase for the taxes paid in 2007, which results in $367 million. So I just think that the foundation of the analysis by OSPB, they relied on the lack of government data to make these guesses. And I've provided you all government data except for the SERI report, which I think is the best thing out there. And what this says is we went out and we, Booz Allen, provided a model and an analysis and da-da-da-da-da, and you're welcome to look at that description, to actually measure what the property taxes were that were collected. So this is a number that says we're relatively confident that that's a number that was collected, as opposed to OSPB that said we just can't track it.
And my last question, I mean, all of this is very complex. I know that the folks at OSPB that work on this are economists. And just so for the record, can you tell me your expertise? I mean, either you were a math major or maybe, you know, you had an undergrad in econ. But just for the record, so I can sort of evaluate the information that you're providing me, can you tell me your expertise or the expertise of the folks that helped you pull this all together?
I'm happy to provide that. My expertise is, I do have a master's in business administration from Northwestern, and I'm a little bit of a wonk in the sense that I started off as a lawyer, took statistics courses at the Department of Agriculture in D.C. just because I liked it. Although I am embarrassed to admit it, perhaps it's my advantage here. So I do have something of a background. I spent 8 years outside of law doing sort of business. So that's sort of the mathematical analysis. I also relied upon the person who's basically the head of tax calculations for Chevron Corporation. And he instructed me that he did not have authorization to testify before this board and has to get corporate clearance. I'll certainly mention OPERA because I don't mean to hold anything back, but I will give you that caveat. So I've had extensive conversations with him. I've also called a few people from, for example, Anadarko, to confirm real gas prices, and they confirmed that basically the prices sort of collapsed in 2000 last year because of the problems with distribution, but those problems have been resolved with new pipelines, so that the prices have actually rebounded. And I've also spoken with Mr. Dempsey, who's here at the Colorado Petroleum Association as well. So no, I'm not an economist, and I do not mean to delay things, and I'm certainly not averse to showing this to the economists. I was hesitant to talk to them in advance, first of all, because I didn't have all these numbers and analysis done, and I did not want to do anything outside of the proponents' views, and that may have been a mistake. If so, I apologize. So I'm not trying to spring anything on people, and would be happy for them to review this and go through that. I understand the timing issues here with respect to the ballot initiative process probably precludes that.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Gessler? On this subject, maybe Mr. Ramey, do you want to respond to the estimate? Or, I mean, I just, if you want.
Not really, Mr. Chair.
That's fine.
I'm absolutely unqualified to do that. In fact, that I have an undergraduate degree in economics.
Yeah, me too.
I don't think I can do I have noticed a couple things that are relatively minor. For example, figure referred to in the few banks raised a couple issues. I assume that OSPB took into account the fact that lowering the exemption for stripper wells will result in some stripper wells not producing it. Frankly, the impact of those, I have absolutely no position. The proponent's position, and frankly, I don't mean this, Mr. Gessler may turn out to be dead right. We come back to the question of consequences that we discussed for about an hour earlier today. But the proponents would opt to go with the OSPB estimate for other reason than that we do have a highly qualified economist that I have to assume engaged as best they could in an analysis similar to Mr. Gessler's data that they thought. That would be the proposed request, is stay with the high end of the OSB without casting any aspersions. Gessler's efforts. or the fact that he may be right and they and we may be wrong.
Thank you. Mr. Gessler, do you want to go on with the rest of your motion for rehearing?
Certainly, and just in the interest of to be complete, I was informed that, well, I'm not absolutely sure about this, that a well producer cannot claim the ad valorem tax credit during the first 2 years of production. And the consequence of that, if you remember correctly in my analysis, I said assumed a slight increase from 2007 to 2008. But in fact, that increase would not exist for purposes of the ad valorem tax, so that would probably stay level. So the numbers should probably be reduced by about 10% based on that factor.
By 10%, you said?
That's what I would guess.
Okay.
The second item on the motion for rehearing, the title fails to identify the percentage of the tax revenues devoted to each spending mandate, thereby omitting critical information necessary to allow voters to make an informed choice. This again connects to the argument I earlier made with respect to the log rolling issues, that you basically have what we would characterize at least as log rolling, a lot of different disparate groups that are receiving benefits from this. Some may be receiving great benefits, some may be receiving very few, if any, benefits. Well, I shouldn't say if any, very few benefits. And that can And that's important information, especially in light of perhaps mitigating the log rolling aspects of it. The third item, the title is incomplete because it does not accurately state that the ad valorem property tax credit is being removed. Basically, the argument here is that we believe that the term ad valorem should be included as a modifier of property tax in this particular initiative. I've got a few reasons for that. One is ad valorem is a specific tax. I looked up in Black's Law Dictionary. I'm happy to provide a copy for the board if they would like. But there are 93 different types of taxes defined in Black's Law Dictionary. And property tax is one of the ones, but it is different and it's broader actually than what an ad valorem tax is. Ad valorem is based on the particular value of the property and in fact is also as part of the definition in Black's. Ad valorem is something that is estimated on an annual basis. This tax here in particular is unique. It's not a normal property tax. It's not a property tax that people would assume by looking at the title initiative, sort of like what they pay, you know, what they pay on their personal residential property taxes. Because the ad valorem tax varies, because the property value varies so dramatically based on the price of oil, that the ad valorem tax here is essentially more analogous to a sales tax. When oil is high, get more money. When oil is low, you get less money because high oil prices produce high property valuations from the basis. So the ad valorem indicates that there's a high variability here, and indeed it's different than simply a property tax that the normal person would understand, normal homeowner, normal business owner would understand. Now I understand ad valorem is not something used often. I at least first say I don't think this would be a catchphrase. I don't think I can't imagine anyone using this as a campaign slogan too. But it does provide an indicator that this is a different type of property tax, and that's sort of analogous to the board's use of certain. Shall something be done and certain things happen? And that's an indicator for people who read this if they want to look at and research a little bit further, look at the initiative. And then finally, I'd argue that it's not unduly cumbersome. I did count the actual words in this ballot title. There are 213. I'm proposing that we add two words. So that's my argument for item number three. For item number four, the title uses the word enhancements as part of the spending mandate. I think enhancements is simply another word for saying increases good things. I think that that's clearly perhaps not a catchphrase, but an improper catch word. That works to the proposal's favor without contributing to voter understanding. Because you're looking at, on this you're looking at, find it.
12.
Enhancements in renewable energy and energy efficiency. Who can be against enhancing energy efficiency? So I think that the term enhancements should be struck as a catchphrase here. Enhancements in this context is simply a synonym for good or better.
Would you suggest another word? Improvements?
preservation of wildlife habitat, perhaps spending related to renewable energy efficiency, something neutral along those lines rather than saying improvements or enhancements, because I think both of those essentially mean good. We're just doing good stuff. I know the related to is sometimes mushy, but it would be sort of a non-biased approach here. With item number 5, the title is incomplete and misleading because it states that scholarships are for state colleges and universities. In fact, the definition of education, higher education, is used in this, excludes certain colleges, but includes occupational education programs. If I may take just a moment to look at my stack of papers, I'll pull out that the exact language that I can refer the board to.
Okay.
So basically, the initiative refers to definitions in 23.18.102, I believe. Higher education is defined by that. And if you look at 23.18.102, subsection 10, okay, it says, yes, 10, it basically says, state institution of higher education means a public post-secondary institution that is governed by, and then it goes through 10 Board of Trustees for the Colorado State, Board of Trustees for University of Colorado. Then in subsection B, it says state institution of higher education does not include a junior college as part of a junior college district organized pursuant to, and then it goes on from there. So in other words, higher education does not include junior colleges. So to say that this provides scholarship for colleges would be misleading because it indicates that colleges includes junior colleges. So in that instance, I think it's misleading. And then it also says, as part of that, if you look at also in section 10, item 10, when I told you there were section 10A, Roman 10, I said public post-secondary institution that's governed by and includes the State Board for Community Colleges and Occupational Education. The occupational education programs would, scholarships for occupational education programs would be included. I would simply argue that it should simply include the term higher education rather than universities, colleges, by using that, the exact language from the initiative. For item number 6, title's incomplete because it fails to inform voters that imposes a new 5% tax on gross income under $300,000 when production meets a certain threshold, and it fails to explain to the voters the magnitude of this change. I think that goes to, and I can specifically focus on the language that I'm referring to, this particular item. It goes to items lines 3 to 4, where it says changing the rate of the tax to 5%. Basically, what this is doing, this is eliminating the old tax, and it is imposing a new tax, and the new tax is higher than the old tax, because it's 5% on everything below $300,000 rather than the scaled amount. So I would argue that changing does not provide adequate information. It could be changed from a higher rate to the 5%. It could be changed from 0% to 5%. It could be changed from 1% or 4%. I think simply imposing a new tax rate of 5% of gross income would be the proper way to do it, because this does impose, and if the board wants, it could also say in removing an earlier tax of a lesser amount or put the exact amount in there. I'm open to either one of those, but I think that that's as written, it's incorrect. The next item. Item number 7, and for this, basically says this, the revenue collection and spending limits also applies to certain other revenue that may be collected and spent by the state or any state district. And basically, all that I'm doing there, and the actual language, 3929105, the language itself reads, The proceeds of this tax received in accordance with the provisions, etc., shall be collected and spent by the state as a voter-approved revenue change without regard to any spending limitation contained within Section 20 of Article 10 of the state constitution or any law, and then here's the operative language, and without limiting in any year the amount of other revenue that may be collected and spent by the state or any district. I'm not exactly sure what that means, but I do think that whatever it means, it is another release from the Tabor restrictions. That's an important thing, and it should be in the ballot title. So I'm not arguing that it's confusing or vague, and I understand that, you know, undefined language within the initiative itself is not, you know, that doesn't necessarily have to be resolved by the board. I'm simply arguing that the board should follow the language of the initiative as it's written as part of the title to inform voters of that. And then the title is incomplete and misleading because it fails to inform voters that the measure reduces the exemption for small well producers by 50%. That's the reduction of the stripper well. It changes the definition of stripper wells, and it reduces that from 15 to 7.5. I understand there's general language to that effect, but I think it should be specific. And again, this goes to my earlier arguments of the magnitude of what's going on here. That the magnitude is important too, and it doesn't add unduly cumbersome or extensive language. This particular one doesn't look for a rewrite. I don't think any of these items look for a rewrite, but changes of words here and there, or slight additions to words, or slight additions to phrases, without major surgery, or I should say major expansion of the number of words in the language. So with that, I'm certainly willing to answer any questions, and I know I tried to be brief in going through all of that.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Gessler? Thank you. Mr. Amy, would you like to respond to those additional objections?
I will. With regard to item two, my only concern with putting the percentages in is that may have the tendency to create clutter. We're going to have a bunch of numbers. It does address the concern. I'm not sure, Mr. Chairman, I think you expressed it, perhaps Mr. Domenico, that given the log rolling concerns, if that helps ameliorate some of that problem, if the board wants to do that, we would have no objection to doing it. I'm afraid it would look cluttered, but...
And that was my the offsetting concern, that I wondered how it would look, but...
We may try it, and the proponents would have no particular objection to doing that. Again, I would note we've got two levels of percentages then, because we've got the 22, 22, and 56 to going into the three funds, and then out of the 56% that goes into the stabilization fund, we have the various percentages going out from there. But if the board thinks it could be done in a way that doesn't turn this into spaghetti, the proponents would certainly not have a substantive objection to that. With regard to number three, if I guess I agree with Ms. Eubank's statement last time that few people know what ad valorem means, but if the board wishes to add those two words, the proponents would have no objection to that. With regard to number four, the way we got into this quagmire with enhancements is that initially the title, I think, referred to clean energy fund. That was suggested as possibly a catchphrase, which is notwithstanding the fact that that's the name of the fund. So we attempted to restate it. The word that comes out of the actual clean energy fund statute itself is advancing energy efficiency, which probably would be more objectionable to the opponents than enhancing it. Having said all that, if there's a more neutral way to state that, I doubt that the proponents would have any objection to that. Number five, if we want to insert higher education, I think I heard Mr. Gessler say for state colleges and universities, the proponents would not object to that. I think state colleges and universities generically is probably better understood by the electorate than higher education. Institutions of higher education probably is something we can't use because that's a defined term, and we do have some things in there that are outside of that defined term. Community, I guess the local district colleges. But perhaps higher education works as well as colleges. With regard to item number six, frankly, I've struggled with that, and I think the way the board has the statement of changing the rate of the tax to 5% of total gross income from the sale of oil and gas is the best way to state it, given the way that this provision operates. Number seven, what is going on there is this. Some people have taken the position that if a measure is de-Bruced, that there is a collateral effect that that will have on the ability of a district to spend revenues that they are receiving from other sources. In other words, if they're now permitted to spend the increased revenues from the source that we are proposing, they have to spend less than they would otherwise be able to spend from other sources which they're currently permitted to expend. All this language is intended to do in the measure is make that neutral and say we are intending to have no effect, direct or indirect, on any funds which the district, the state in this case, may otherwise be able to spend or not be able to spend. It's a neutral provision. Now, how you put that in the title, I don't know, but it would emphasize that the point is not to have this provision have an effect on that other spending. It's to keep this provision neutral as to that other spending. So it is what it is, as if this provision never existed. Finally, number eight, the 50%, the proponents would be fine if the board feels they want to put another number in there. Again, we're dealing on the point where clutter starts outweighing completeness, and we may be getting to that stage, but substantive objection.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Ramey? Guess not. Then I believe there's no one else signed up to testify. Then I'll turn to board discussion of the motions for rehearing. Yes, we'll take a moment here. Okay, let's then turn to board discussion on the motions for rehearing. As I recall, we pretty much discussed the single subject issue, or was that in a previous lifetime?
I think we handled that part.
Okay. Any comments on the other objections to the board's previous action?
Well, I'll start with the issue of the size of the tax increase is related to what we already spent a lot of time talking about. And while Mr. Gessler's research and work is certainly impressive, it really highlights to me why we should just take whatever number the petitioners think is right. Otherwise, we're going to get into a battle of where the three of us are sitting here looking at two piles of research and two spreadsheets and comparing the undergraduate educations of various people that proponents and opponents bring in, and that's enough of a problem. Even more of a problem is somehow this would be turned into this board, the three of us, deciding whether a tax is going to bring in $300 million or $600 and some million. I mean, if the three of us have no business saying whether the tax should be capped at $300 or $600 million, and it really highlights to me why A, we should interpret this as a cap, because otherwise someone really should be able to come up with a really good number, and we are just not equipped to do that. And second, it just highlights the complete uncertainty of what the numbers are if that isn't interpreted in the way I think it should be. And so I'm where I was before, that that this number should be up to the proponents, that it should be interpreted as a cap. I think Mr. Gessler brings up a good point that it may not really make sense for that number to be stuck in at the title board hearing, that it probably should be hashed out in a more appropriate forum. On the other hand, if it were up to me, the proponents would just say, here's the number to put in there, and there'd be no discussion about it whatsoever. And it would be a matter for fighting out in the campaign for or against it. Otherwise, I see no legitimate reason to pick one number over another. And even if I did, I'd be nervous about the three of us having that kind of power.
I think again, reflecting our earlier discussion, I think I feel an obligation to make a good faith estimate based on the information in front of us, even though I recognize that our qualifications are somewhat suspect. It's just that legally we're required to do it.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I don't understand what we're legally required to do. We're legally required to put a number in there that is the amount it'll raise the first year, and the number we put in there is the amount it'll raise the first year. And so I don't understand why we should trust one spreadsheet over another rather than just saying that this is going to be the cap.
Well, and I wasn't going to suggest trusting one or the other. I'm just saying I think we have an obligation to make a good faith, to pick a good faith number. Now, what we have, I think in this case, is two different estimates. Both from, I think, credible. I think they're both credible from what I've heard. I think the estimate from OSPB is credible primarily because of the source and their qualifications. What we don't have from OSPB is the benefit of their analysis. And I believe that OSPB estimates are credible and trustworthy, and if that's all we had, I'm pretty comfortable with that. On the other hand, we have from Mr. Gessler what I believe is a credible estimate as well. Now, it may not be as neutral, but it's better substantiated. And to the extent that I followed the analysis, it seems credible. I don't have a basis for picking one number or the other. Like I say, I think they're both credible. I guess just for the sake of fulfilling the obligation to make a good faith estimate, I would average the two. I would take Mr. Gessler's number, reduced by 10%, as he indicated probably it should be, take that number and average it with the $321.4 million from OSPB. I don't know whether there's any support for that. That ends up being $451.0 million would be the estimate I would suggest. I'm also fine with picking a number, or even going along with the being heavily influenced by proponents' preferences, except that I don't think that dictates the answer. I think independently we still have to put a number in that we believe could be the amount raised by the measure according to its language in the first full fiscal year.
Well, here's the one thing we know for essentially certain. None of these estimates are accurate. None of them is going to turn out to be the actual number. And so, we could flip a coin, we could draw numbers out of a hat, we could split the difference. None of that makes any sense to me as a matter of, the good faith number we have to put in there is the number that it's going to raise. And I think there might be a problem if we thought it was going to raise far less than the number the proponents wanted to put in there because of the language that Tabor uses. Then I might have some difficulty simply accepting their number. But when the adjustments in tax rates that they're proposing and the elimination of certain credits means that they're going to run up into a cap, then our good faith estimate is simply to put in what the cap is. And if they want to, if and seems to me the way Tabor, sort of the structure of it works, is that it's got an internal cap. Even if you're messing around with tax rates or creating a new tax rate, that it's got a dollar amount cap. And if we, whatever number we put in there, as long as it's not over our best estimate, then it seems to me we've discharged our duty. And splitting the difference and trying to adjust here and there for errors that may have been made in various things is just completely beyond what the title board should be doing. And it seems to me if we put a number in there that will effectively be a cap, then we've done our duty, and doing anything else is really pretty remarkable, that because we decided to split the difference, it may be that Colorado taxpayers end up paying 200 and some million more dollars in taxes simply because that was the best we could come up with. I would rather put that on the shoulder of the proponents, let them come up with a number and have that be the cap, and then let it be a political fight if that's too low or too high.
Moving a little bit in that direction, I think I would prefer, rather than the average that I suggested, a different average, and that's to start with the low estimate from OSPB, which I think was $253.3 million. That's the low estimate. We've got a high estimate from Mr. Gessler, and I would average those two. And I'm taking into account the proponents' belief from their own independent sources, although I don't think they used numbers, but I think they indicated that their independent assessment was that the OSPB estimate was high. So that also pushes me towards believing that if we're going to try to pick a number, which I think we're obligated to do, that it ought to be somewhere in between the low and the high, and that actually would be $417 million. And I don't know whether anybody, I mean, we have just a different point of view of it. I just feel like we've got to pick a number, and I think it's got to be driven by the language of the measure. And I understand there's legal consequences of that, but I'm just trying to follow the dictates of Tabor. So I don't know, Ms. Eubanks, would you have
you
any
want
comments?
Me to say something?
I don't know whether we will. The issue being, is there a support for changing the number that the board has previously inserted in the title?
Well, I think the difficulty here is the fact that the best we can do in terms of the information that's given to us are estimates, and that's what estimates are. They're always wrong because they're either higher or lower. I mean, that's the nature of the beast, and how we deal with it. I do have to disagree with Mr. Domenico's characterization. I don't think that proponents can come in and just pick a number. I think there has to be some basis, whether it's the estimates, and as imperfect as that they are, I think there's a basis for coming up with a number. Yes, we do ask them, you know, for their input, their comfort levels, the risks that they're willing to take in terms of the numbers, especially when there's a disagreement as to the estimates. But I think, you know, we have to put a number in. What the effect of that number is remains to be seen. We all have our opinions until we see a situation where it actually plays out. I don't know what that answer is. And so I don't know that I'm able to take Mr. Gessler's number, even with the 10% reduction, because of some of the issues that I raised. I think it may be somewhat lower than that, based on his assumptions. Whether we stick with the number we have, whether we average it, as Mr. Hobbs is suggesting, it's pretty much, you know, a shot in the dark based on what people with more expertise than we have can tell us in terms of that information.
But, and I guess I'm kind of beating a dead horse, but it's not just a shot in the dark. The number we put in there, whether it has an effect just the first year or forever, has a huge impact on how much people are going to pay, or at least it can, unless it comes in under that number.
I don't disagree with that.
So it should be up to the proponents how much tax they want to impose or ask the people to impose on themselves, not on us. And it's much better, it seems to me, to let the proponents take the shot in the dark than for us to take a shot in the dark. Because, as you say, nobody can tell us what these numbers are going to be. But we're putting a number in there that's going to have some effect. So the best we can do is say, effectively, what Tabor lets proponents do is create a new tax or adjust taxes, but they inherently have a limit on how much they can raise. And so proponents can say, we want to change the tax in such a way to raise this much money. And why we should overrule their decision on how much money it should raise, I don't understand.
And I think that if they draft the measure in such a way to generate so much revenue, that's their way of controlling the amount.
But
I mean, if based on the text of the measure and based on sort of best information available, we're told through folks that deal with these types of estimates all the time that a particular tax proposal is going to generate $300 million. I don't know. Now, if the proponents want to generate only $200 million, then they should draft their measure that way. But based on the text of the measure and based sort of on the facts known, everything else remains the same. I think the best information available is going to be the estimate that comes from the experts.
I agree that that's the best estimate
and so
available.
You go with the 300, even though now they say 200, even though they could have drafted the measure to have a $200 million fiscal impact. I think we're obligated to try to come up with an estimate based on the text of the measure rather than an arbitrary choice that may be for a lot of reasons other than factual. I mean, if they want to control the amount of revenue that they generate, they do that through the way they draft the
Except
measure.
The one fact we actually know is that the number we put in there is the top end, at least for the first year, and I would say forever. So the one fact we know is that. And so whatever we put in there is the top end. And so if we start shifting that around, we are changing based on our guess, on our analysis of things we don't really know or understand very well. We're changing the one thing that we could know for sure, which is the cap. And what I'm essentially, the only way I can make sense of how Tabor interacts with these titles is that inherent in every measure is a cap, and that the proponents that you have to, because of the language of Tabor, read that into the structure, read that into every tax raising measure. Otherwise, it doesn't make any sense to me. And so I mean, the idea that we would say, well, the proponents say the cap should be at 321.4, but we've got these estimates, and so we're going to say 417 or 502. It doesn't make any sense to me. I don't see where we have an obligation to do that, given that it affects a cap. I would agree if that language had essentially was just an estimate of what we thought it would raise, and if it went over or under that, so be it. But when it actually affects a limit, then we've discharged our duty, and otherwise, we're changing what the proponents are trying to do, it seems to me, if we put a higher cap on it than what they want there to be. And it's just, I mean, in this case, it was complicated enough. But if we start getting into this business, next time Mr. Ramey won't just let us get away with his characterization of what his people thought. He'll come in with his own estimates, and then I don't think I want to go down that road.
Mr. Ramey?
Mr. Chair, let me just comment with a request. I'm going to ask the board not to do an average, because frankly, I think that's probably the worst number that we can come up with, because it doesn't mean anything. It's just averaging numbers. And I tend to agree with Mr. Domenico, though I'm not going to take him up on the threat to anything. Referring to Tabor, the way that the language reads for the estimate is it's supposed to be for the first full fiscal year of each proposed district tax increase, district estimates of the maximum dollar amount of each increase. And I'm referring to that B3 section that triggers the cap or the lowering of the tax refund. In a normal tax increase situation, it would be the district who would be, not the title board or any other group that would be making the estimate, it would be the district proposing a tax. In this case, we don't have a district proposing a tax. We have proponents proposing a tax. And I guess, as close as we could come to complying with Tabor in the context of a citizen-initiated initiative is to read district to mean the proponents. Let us propose the tax in good faith. And I think the board does have an obligation to hold us into the realm of reality. With some basis for what we're doing, and our basis is the high end of the OSPB estimate, but to defer to our choice in that regard. As Mr. Domenico says, if we're wrong, there's a consequence. We can argue about what that consequence may look like, but there certainly is a consequence to us. I would certainly submit it's more than just a one-year refund. And if we start raising the number, obviously that creates political issues for us, which are sort of the least consideration here, but it also does precisely what Mr. Domenico says. If we do come in with $500 million, we get to keep it all then, over and above what our intention was. So I guess the closest we would come to complying with Tabor, I think, would be to view the proponent's estimate as the district estimate, as the language would be intended in Tabor. District isn't making an estimate here. And defer to us as long as we have some basis for saying what we're saying, and not substitute a board judgment. I agree, Mr. Domenico. I don't know how you do that, other than making estimates which don't comport with anything other than the fact that they're just averages.
Ms. Eubanks.
And I have to disagree with Mr. Ramey. only in the sense that I do think you have district here, and that's the state. And under, you know, Article 5, Section 1, the right of initiative in terms of lawmaking is the same and equal to what the General Assembly makes in terms of a law. So in terms of what the people are proposing, I view that as at the same level as if the General Assembly was proposing a tax increase. And so you do have a district. It is the state. And for the, either the proponent, for it to be an initiated measure or a referred measure, I viewed the title board as having the obligation to come up with the state's estimate, you know, that is used for purposes of Tabor. I mean, we're the state entity that is acting in this regard, just like the General Assembly, when it comes up with its title for a referred measure, fills in the blank of the estimate for the ballot title. And so I see it a little different. And so I'm not willing to defer to proponents quite as much as you might suggest in terms of as action of a district. But I do think that it passed where we've had competing estimates, we tend to go with OSPB. And so I think I'm fine staying with the 321.4 that we set in the title originally.
And I'm fine with that as well. I mean, it's still within the range between the low end and the high end, and I'm fine with that. So I really do think, I mean, this is an important discussion. I really feel like if the proponents want to set the amount, they need to do that in the measure itself. They can do it, as Ms. Eubanks, I think, was suggesting, is they can set the rates and so forth so that they can guess it's going to be the amount that they're targeting, or they can just write a cap in. They're perfectly free to draft the measure that way, but I don't think we can delegate to proponents or anybody else the title setting responsibility for what that what the language of the measure will drive. So in any event, I it sounds like there's no support for changing the title. I guess I'd suggest we move on to the other objections to the title.
I suggest we do insert the percentages, even though this one's kind of confusing. Of course, I've been suggesting that for every one of these we've seen, so I'll stop there.
Could you just, and I've indicated I'm really willing to do that now. If, again, I'd like a better picture of what it would look like and what complications we may face. Can you just tell me real roughly before we put anything on the board kind of how simple or how complicated that would be?
Well, this one, unfortunately, is more complicated than usual because within number three, there are the numbers 1 and 2 that we've got up there on line 9, I think, would simply get, where does it go?
22% each?
Yeah. Is that right? Yeah, 22% each. The problem then is that the remaining 56% that go to 3 is split up into its 5 or 6, whatever it is, 3 or 4 subcategories. So I'm not sure if it makes sense to do a little bit of math and say 22% after 22% to the severance tax trust fund, 22% to the local government severance tax fund, and 3 the remainder to the severance tax stabilization trust fund, which would distribute and then do whatever the 60% of 56%, or if there's a better way to do it.
Mr. Ramey.
Offer one caution to the board. The design of this measure, if you recall, is sort of, there's a whole harmless aspect of this by intent. In other words, the 22 and the 22% are to the severance tax trust fund and the local government severance tax fund are supposed to be roughly what they're receiving now. Increased portion of the tax is supposed to be that which is divvied up through the state. Therefore, rather than taking percentages, probably make the most sense if you want to put those in. Have the 22 and 22 and 56, and then actually with regard to the 56, use the percentages of the 56, which would be, for example, for the scholarship provision, 60%. Because the 60% going to scholarships represents the portion of the increased revenue as this measure is designed to operate. So that will really more accurately inform the voters of where the increased revenue stream is going. Otherwise, you've got a lower number there, and it sort of loses track of where the increase is going. I don't know if I'm making any sense or not.
Well, maybe I'm misunderstanding, but if we're talking about saying 22 and 22 and then 60 and 15 and 10 and 10 and 5, I mean, isn't the voter going to be confused by this is all going to add up to more than 100%?
Well, what I'm suggesting, I guess, is if this can be done in some way that is readable, is starting on line 9, specify percentages of the tax revenues to be credited to 1, 22% to the severance tax trust fund, 2, 22% of local government severance tax fund, and 3, 56% to the severance tax stabilization fund, which the measure creates to be, and then you're going to have to change the wording there a little bit, to use 60% to scholarships, blah, 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 blah. But to keep the distribution within the stabilization fund sort of matching the percentages in here. Otherwise, we lose track of the fact that we've got sort of this whole harmless and we're divvying up the increased revenue. Now, you could do it the other way where you're taking 60% of 56%. You're going to have weird percentages then.
Yeah, your way is the way to do it.
Ms. Eubanks?
It's worse than that, because not only is it 60% of, what, the 56%, it's of the 56%, it's the 90% that goes to the operational account, which then 60% is used for scholarships.
And it's worse than that, because then we have the
flow, I know, and the 10% that's going to the perpetual base account. I know.
I think Ms. Eubanks is correct that the only practical way to do it is 22, 22, 56. Lock the percentages in. I think that reflects this design as well.
Mr. Gessler?
I was and probably still will continue to agree with Mr. Ramey's approach on that. and perhaps, you know, for item number 3, say you have the 56 and say of which approximately such and such percentage shall be used for A, such and such percentage for B, such and such. So the of which indicates that it's of the 56%. And perhaps the use of approximately will help solve some of those problems. I mean, our concern to a great extent is precision is very important, obviously. But I recognize you have to balance that against complexity. And here, what we're trying to focus on is the magnitude of the distributions. So, I think that gets.
Can we start out by doing the 22, 22, 56 at least, and then see if we can come up with a way to break it down further?
Ms. Eubanks?
And I'm fine with that. Part of the difficulty, I mean, if you were going to, I don't know, grammatically be correct, I mean, the way that we lumped it right now in terms of the title we said requiring specified percentages of the tax revenues. So if you were to change it in the normal sense, it seems like you'd say, requiring 22% of the tax revenues to be credited to this and 22 to that, and which makes it long and I'm not sure improved. And so I'm just wondering whether we could sort of keep the language as it is, but then at the end of where it says like severance tax trust fund, and I don't know whether it would be confusing, but you know, you put in parens 22% at the end to be an indicator, so you're still saying specified percentages of the tax revenues and don't have to continue to restate that over and over again. Or maybe you do a hyphen and then say, you know, 22, the number 22 with the percent sign, to give that indication without doing it, I don't know.
Yeah, the only other way I think you could do it is to say, I don't think you'd have to repeat all of it in every one. You could say requiring the tax revenues to be credited 22% to the severance tax trust fund.
Well, you could change it to say requiring the following percentages of the tax revenues.
And I might suggest, by the way, however, I'm not sure the best approach here, but that the paren 1, 2, 3 be changed to ABC to help distinguish. If we're going to use numbers for the percentages, it might help just make it more readable.
Yeah, or you could say requiring the tax revenues to be credited as follows: a 22% to the Severance Tax Trust Fund.
Should we try that?
Don't strike the tax revenues.
Yeah, leave the tax revenues.
Yeah, so strike through of.
The 2 at the end of that, I think.
Right there. As follows.
As follows, colon.
And before the, after the, no. Oh, you're going to change it to A. That's fine.
Yeah, I think A and B, C is better.
Okay. And then before the severance tax trust fund language, say, and I do it numerically, so 22 and then the percent sign to the, and then you got the, so, and then down you do, again, before the local government severance tax trust, insert, oh, yeah, change that to B. And 22%. And then change 3 to C. Insert 56. Percent of. Of, oh, 2, sorry. I'm just wondering whether or not it would help us, because otherwise it gets so long, whether it's helpful to put a sim after which the measure creates, and then, I mean, to sort of, that's your initial three-tier split. And then to specifically talk again about the Severance Tax Stabilization Trust Fund in terms of whatever we're going to do with the rest of it, to try to break it up. I
guess, sir.
Perhaps to say 56% to the created Severance Tax Stabilization Trust Fund. So at least it gets rid of the which the measure creates clause.
Say a new.
A new.
That's fine, too.
Okay. Let's try that.
So you'd strike the on line, at the end of line 10.
Yeah, I think the reason it's as it is because in the past it was easier to lead into the to be used to fund, but if we're going to change that, this is probably better.
So then insert A, new, and then strike the comma after fund through 8. I think it should be a semicolon. Now the hard part.
Right. I mean, you could sort of repeat what we said above and saying,
well, you could
directing that funds, that the money in the Severance Tax Stabilization Fund be distributed as follows. I also,
I'll just provide a couple suggestions here. Perhaps I, you know, do a new severance tax stabilization trust fund, say, of which 10% shall go to the perpetual base account, comma, and then multiply your 60% times your 90%, 6% to this. So that gives you the direct percentages, derived percentages, that are accurate, and you're not really moving into, you know, the effect of this in any speculative manner. It's mathematical. That's maybe one way to do it. Another way to do it, which is a little bit more complex, I think, from a word standpoint, would be to say a New Severance Stabilization Trust Fund, and you say which shall be divided 10% to the perpetual base account and 90% to the operational account, of which 60% shall go to.
Can't we just skip the perpetual base account and just do your original idea, basically say this, of which 56% is to be used to fund scholarships, and then whatever the math on the other ones, 90% of the other numbers.
As I've thought about it, instead of saying the approximate, I think it would make sense to say, you know, 10% to the perpetual and then 56%, so voters do sort of see it add up to 100%. But if you want to exclude the 10% and just say 56% to scholarships, sort of use those mathematical derivations, I guess I'd be fine with that. I'm just trying to provide a couple options.
Yeah.
I comment just briefly on that point. Ultimately, all the money goes according to the percentages, because if you recall, the perpetual base account is capped by the preceding year's revenue, so it's going to go down. So to avoid all kinds of complexity that really comes out to the same percentages in the long run, all the stabilization account, all the perpetual base account is doing the same cash flow. I guess I think I would agree with Mr. Domenico's comment that don't get into the perpetual base versus the operational account, but just use the percentages. Roughly, that's what's going to
happen. And perhaps use the word approximately to signal that this isn't exact.
If the board feels compelled to use the word approximately, that would be fine. The actual effect of the stabilization through the perpetual base account is so minor.
Mm-hmm.
The way it's been designed, approximately almost suggests that there's more variance in there from the stated percentages than there will be. But if the board feels that they wish to.
And just on behalf of Mr. Dempsey, we'd be fine with that.
Let's do it. If anybody remembers what it was.
Well, I don't know, you could say majority, but that doesn't, majority of the funds to be used, blah, 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 but that doesn't, I mean. As you say, most of the. Go to the trust fund. Most of, let's see, then we'd go back to a comma rather than a semicolon. Something like, with most of these revenues to be used to.
I don't mean to interrupt Ms. Eubanks.
No, be my guest.
If I may.
I'm struggling.
Because this path, I think, is going to cause a problem ultimately here. All of the revenue is going to be used ultimately according to the percentages that are stated in the measure. It's just that the use of the perpetual base account slows it down slightly. And as the 56% decreases eventually coming into that account,
there will be a spillover out of that, out of the perpetual basic account, the operational account, and ultimately all of the funds, all of them, 100%, are going to be distributed through the operational account as defined by the percentages. All the perpetual basic account does is slow it down so that there aren't quite the peaks and valleys that might appear otherwise. And my fear is using language like with most of the revenues to be used as follows suggests some revenues are going someplace else. We're staying forever in the perpetual basic account, and they're not. They're all going to come out, and only a little more slowly than if it came out 100% on a year-to-year basis. So approximately is okay, because there will be a little differential from year to year, but to suggest that some money is going someplace other than as stated here, that would be inaccurate and misleading.
And that's due to the 125% of the previous fiscal year's
exactly
revenue.
And the 125% of the 56% is merely a tamping mechanism that eventually will go down and force all of the money out of the perpetual base account into the operational account to be distributed 60%, 15, 15, and so forth. So I would strongly urge against putting some language in there that suggests that there's some money that's going someplace else or staying forever in the perpetual base account, because it's not. It's all going to come out 60, 15,
15. Yeah, I think I'd be okay with just saying of which 60% is to be used to fund scholarships, blah, 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 and then of which approximately 60%.
I mean, really, frankly, the more I think about it, would be more accurate to say 60%, because at the end of the day, it'll be 60%. I'm not quibbling too much.
How long before that day comes? Are we talking about a time period where you can say in a year or two?
Oh, it's longer than that, and I can't answer that question accurately, Mr. Chair. It depends on the continued drilling activity and the exhaustion of non-renewable resources. It's not that long. Matter of decades as opposed to centuries, but it's at the end of a moderate period of time, the distribution will be, per assuming the General Assembly doesn't change this, the distribution will be per the percentages we stated. 60%, it will be 60% to scholarships. Now in year three, there's going to be some money sitting in the perpetual base account, granted, but at the end of the day, it's going to be 60% scholarships, not 61 or 59, but 60. I think that was where Mr. Domenico was about to go, and I think he's correct.
Well, and I may be okay with just going to 60%, not even saying approximately. I guess I am struggling with that, because it sounds like initially it's 90% of 60%, it's 54%. But again, the titles, I'm not sure I want to say this out loud, I'm not sure that the titles have to be perfect in the sense of covering. I mean, I'm trying to set fair and accurate titles, and is 60% reasonably fair and accurate?
Sort of from a phased-in perspective, sort of fully phased-in, yeah.
I mean, once you start modifying that, you're suggesting that somehow that some other percentage may be the actual percent. And 60% is what it's going to be over time. All this stabilization does is tamp it a bit so it doesn't have to precipitate the cycles. It will be 60%.
Yeah, I don't think taking it out will materially mislead anybody about it in the sense that someone would... Any conceivable, reasonable person would say, well, I voted for this because I understood the number would actually be 60% every year, and it turned out to be 57% one year. So I don't necessarily think it's material to have it in there. And in another sense, it is somewhat material, could be materially misleading to leave it in there, in that it gives a sense that it's not a strict number, that it can be played around with by whoever's operating the fund. And so I guess, especially if Mr. Ramey's willing to take it out, I would take it out.
We just say of which 60% is used to fund, because then we're going to have to say, and when we get down to preservation, then it's going to be
15% to fund. Yeah. And to fund.
You want to, and just drop used? Maybe even up with the 60% strike used also? To so that of which 60%?
I think I would leave it, but I think once you've said it once,
okay.
I don't think you need to say it again.
So just 15%
you may need to read it.
Okay.
And then I think it's 15% again. Or no, 10%.
Yes.
And then 10%
for transportation.
I think that reads pretty well, considering. I'm okay with it.
I think it's okay as shown on the screen.
I think there should be is there a space when we're at 15% to fund?
Yeah, there's
space. Okay, it's just okay.
There's an extra space on line 10 after fund before the comma.
Before the B?
No, at the beginning of. Yeah. Should I move those changes? Are we ready for that?
Okay. All
right. I move those changes.
Second. Further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Further changes to the titles, Ms. Eubanks?
In terms of the use of the word enhancements, while I'm agreeable to change it, whether or not we change it to advancements, whether Mr. Gessler thinks that's any better in terms of it tracks the statutory language, or whether or not, I don't know if it makes any difference, maybe we just get rid of enhancements in. So it's 10% to fund renewable energy and energy efficiency.
Mr. Domenico.
I thought you might be able to do something like that and just at the end say, after efficiency, say programs. I'm not totally familiar with how that fund works, but
and I just don't know whether they're all for programs per se.
Yeah,
or
I don't
whether
know if programs.
Mr. Gessler.
Thank you, Mr. House. We'd be agreeable to removing the phrase enhancements in, and then adding programs after efficiency. That works fine.
I mean, I know programs can have kind of a term of art in government talk, but I think in normal person talk it just means stuff that has to do with renewable energy, and I doubt that fund has anything that's not related to something like that in the sort of general use of the term.
Or entitled board talk similar to the word certain.
Yes, certain.
Mr. Ramey.
Mr. Chair, that would be acceptable. You know, legally, and I've got the clean energy fund definitions here, as opposed to attract investment, assist in technology transfer, provide provide market incentives, implementation of projects.
Are those broken down in percentages?
No.
Within that?
You know, if they were, I'm not about to monkey with those.
I think those are all programs in the typical sense of the word.
The only other language is any other man who serves the purposes of advancing the energy. Purposes is such a weird word. So programs might be as good as we can do. But that's a layman's word and not a legal word.
Yeah.
I'll move the change as shown by Ms. Gomez on the screen so that that portion reads 10% to fund renewable energy and energy efficiency programs.
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0.
Did we dispense with the ad valorem issue? I don't think it needs to go in there.
I'm okay with the title as is.
At that point, yes.
Mr. Gessler?
Can I just make one last ditch attempt? And I guess we do feel somewhat strongly about this, but I mean, ad valorem is a specific type of property tax, and it's an indicator as to what's going on. And I would analogize it to the board's frequent use of the term certain. And the board's reasoning, I think, has been certain sort of provides an indicator that there's more going on and that certain means something. By the same token, ad valorem means something here. And the concern is that, the stability of property taxes that most people are used to, most people are used to property taxes based on market value of the desirability of the property rather than the market value of a commodity. And because a huge portion of people Colorado directly pay property taxes, whether it's business or commercial. That has a certain meaning in people's minds. And ad valorem, these taxes are really sort of more akin to a sales tax, so heavily driven by commodity prices. That's why we're and looking for that indicator of ad valorem.
Ms. Eubanks?
And I guess I have to disagree with Mr. Gessler, because I think all the property taxes that people pay, whether it's on residences or commercial, it's all ad valorem because it's based on value, and that's what the word is indicating. So all property taxes are ad valorem taxes. I mean, property tax is really sort of a short form for ad valorem taxes. And so I don't think that ad valorem in this context is going to add anything in the sense that ad valorem for wells being any different than ad valorem for residential or commercial, and it doesn't mean that it's based on production versus anything else. It's based on value, and that's what the Latin term means, and that's what ad valorem tax, it's based on the value of the property. That's my understanding, at least, and that's why I'm not inclined to insert ad valorem.
I may say one more thing for the record, and then I'll sit down. I'm happy to pass out definitions from Black's Dictionary. I have enough copies for everyone. But according to this, an ad valorem tax is a tax for a fixed proportion of the value of the property with respect to which the tax is assessed and requires the intervention of assessors or appraisers to estimate the value of such property before the amount due from each taxpayer can be determined. And that's done on an annual basis for oil and gas ad valorem, whereas the definition of property tax is a tax levied on the owner of property, especially real property, usually based on the property's value. Not necessarily. And here we have oil and gas taxes are specifically reevaluated every year, whereas property taxes sometimes are 2 to 3 years before they're reassessed. So there is that greater stability in that change. So there is a difference. Not a meaningful one, and I can understand.
Do producers, do the people who take this credit pay two different kinds of property tax? Do they pay both an ad valorem and some other kind of property tax?
No, they just pay an ad valorem tax.
I mean, when you look at Section 3 of Article 10, which is the constitutional basis for property tax in the state, it talks about the way different properties are valued, such as residential being market. And it has that basically production, the wells, it's based on law, but it can be done on production. And so it's all property tax comes out of this provision, and it's always based on value. It's just the method of valuation that may differ between wells and residential property or commercial. There's just a different basis for how you determine the valuation, but they're all, in my mind, ad valorem taxes.
When I was in college, in the High Middle Ages course, we had an extra credit question to determine which two saints debated how many angels could dance on the head of a pin.
Right.
So I recognize we're approaching that area. I'd simply say, we like it. I don't think it adds much complexity or cumbersomeness, and it seems as though the proponents don't object, so I would make a cost-benefit argue here.
On a different objection raised by Mr. Gessler's motion for rehearing, I am wondering about in line 11, whether this goes to the issue about the title saying state colleges and universities. Is it better to say something like used to fund higher education scholarships for Colorado residents? I think that was a suggestion I heard.
Well, the only issue with that is it might suggest you could use them anywhere. I'm not sure I have a problem with it as is, but you could say state institutions of higher education, which I think is the language in the measure, and I think avoids the potential definitional difficulty.
Mr. Ramey.
The problem with that is, this is a technical one, Mr. Domenico, state institutions of higher education is a defined term. In the measure, it states as defined in Section 2318.102, and it leaves out the local district colleges, which are separately described in another section. So I guess I have a little hesitancy to use the phrase that Mr. Domenico used, because it is a defined statutory term that is not inclusive of covering. I was suggesting just using...
Oh, yeah, that's what we... That was the problem last time.
Exactly, which posed the problem. We could refer to it all as higher education, because it all is, though that's a bit over-inclusive because it includes the junior colleges, which are not part of this. Colleges, state colleges and universities... To me, that's about as close as you can come. I like the language as it is, but I'm not going to kick and fuss if you change
okay.
it to higher education. But don't use that defined term would be my recommendation.
Any other suggestions for changes to the title? I'll suggest that change the title to all caps. Mr. Domenico, before we do that?
Before you do that, the business about the 5% changing the tax on gross income under $300,000, I thought you might resolve that without causing too much harm by just... maybe it doesn't solve it at all, but in lines 4 and 5, just getting rid of the rate of, and so it would just say changing the tax to 5% of total gross income, because I think part of the problem was that Mr. Gessler suggested that the current language suggested all you're doing really is changing the rate, when really you're changing the rate and applying it in a new way, and so if you got rid of that, I don't know if it solves the problem, but that was the only thing I could think of to address that concern.
Would change.
It would just say changing the tax to 5% of total gross income, and then the rest of that clause actually incorporates the concern expressed in the petition for the motion for rehearing, in that it incorporates the $300,000 limit, and so this way you're not giving the signal that all you're doing is changing the rate of the tax. You're changing the tax, and here's how it applies, 5%. And so it doesn't explicitly say that I think the problem with the old way was basically we were saying, it seemed to be saying you're changing the tax rate, and that's it. And this way, I think it says you're changing the tax, and the tax is now 5%, and it's got this limit. And so I think it's the best I can do without really rewriting, and I don't even know if you could capture that concern. But it seems to me to resolve the potential problem of falsely signaling that the only change is this, the rate, that you're changing a lot about the tax, or more than just the rate. That's all. I don't really see it. I don't know that it solves the problem, but it doesn't seem to have a downside, and it may address it a little bit.
I'll move that change.
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Then I'll move that we change the titles to all caps, because I think it's pretty clear in this case this is a tax increase that subject to Tabor's requirements.
Second.
Further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. And I will move then that the board deny the motions for rehearing, except to the extent that the board has amended the titles. And again, the understanding is that all the changes we made in the title would be reflected in the ballot title and submission clause as well. Is there a second?
Second.
Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. That completes action on number 113, and the time is 7:47 p.m. Mr. Stedman, I don't know. We might have to take a break before we...
I promise to be quick. Let's go on to the next. I'd like to take the next two agenda items together.
Court reporter.
She.
I don't know. She's chit chatting, so.
I don't think she's here for this too. She's just here for the severance tax
one. Somebody has to ask for it.
Yeah.
Oh.
So the next good that I know. Two agenda items are 91A and number 128. And for the record, representing the Attorney General on the title board for these two measures, we have Jeff Blue, Deputy Attorney General. These two measures are before the board on motions or a motion for rehearing submitted by Douglas Bruce. Mr. Stedman, representing proponents.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Pat Stedman on behalf of the proponents, and in the interest of time, we would just say we would concur in part of the motion for rehearing in that we would request the board change the title to appear all in caps. I'm not aware of what other faults with the title of the motion for rehearing is alleging, and we'd ask you to make no further changes.
And again, Mr. Bruce is not present. I believe, as I recall, his motion for rehearing said, among other faults, Tabor requires the titles to be in all capital letters, but I don't recall that any other faults were specified.
That was my understanding as well from reading his motion, and I expected that he would be here to elaborate on what he thought was additionally at fault.
I'll then move that the titles for number 91A and number 128 be converted to all capitals.
Second.
Any discussion? Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no. Are there any other changes to the titles? If not, and I'm not quite sure whether we're granting the motion for rehearing, the motions for rehearing in their entirety or not, but in maybe the cautious approach, since Mr. Bruce said among other faults, I guess I'll make a motion that for both 91A and number 128, the board deny the motion for rehearing, except to the extent that the board has changed the titles.
Second.
Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. That concludes action on number 91A and 128. The time is 7:50 p.m. And that concludes the agenda. So we will be adjourned until 8:30 tomorrow morning, and we have two more measures tomorrow morning. Thank you all.